Ready?
I think we're ready.
All right.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Interim Committee on Higher Ed and Workforce Development on Tuesday, November 14th, 2017. And I'm delighted to see everybody here again. This is, I missed September, so it's been a long time since I've seen a couple of you folks, and it's good to be back with you. A couple of changes. We have a couple of fine additions to the team here. And so we have Representative Noble. So welcome.
Thank you.
To our welcome. Committee.
And where did she go?
Fahey.
Then we have, well, oh, Rep. Fahey was
yeah.
here before, but I wasn't. So I feel like this is a
you
new experience for me.
You can welcome her as well, yeah.
So Representative Noble, just so you know, when you're new, you have to sit a couple seats down. So
I am.
Yeah.
And then I checked on my way down, and it is true that Rep. Johnson is not there, and his office is pretty close to vacant. And it's kind of sad. He's been such a great member of this committee and to the whole House as a whole. So I think it's a big loss for us. It's great for the Oregon Business
Association.
And industry.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I knew there was an I in there somewhere.
And the Johnson payroll budget.
Yeah. So good for them. I think we'll still probably see him from time to time. Mark made a tremendous contribution to this group, and I'm going to truly miss him. Today is kind of a interesting mix of things. So we're going to start out with some look at, more of, it's going to sound a little bit K-12-ish, but it's trying to figure out are we really tying together what's happening at the high school level in terms of, the whole student experience and, what are they seeing from their counselors? What tools do the counselors have to work with? And how are they being prepared for their career and college decisions that they have to make? So what's that system look like? Is that being bridged well and so forth? So background information there. And then the second part is just kind of a review and update on what happens at the different secondary institutions, so community colleges and private and public universities and so forth. So we're kind of get an overview there, get kind of warmed up for the 2018 session that's going to be here before we know it. Mm-hmm. 70 days from today, I think, for those of you that are counting. So. Anyway, so with that, I'm opening an. Oops, I got to hit this first. I'm opening an informational meeting on career and college readiness in Oregon K-12 schools. So we've got about an hour and a half for that. And so, if you'd like the guys would like to come up and join us, that'd be great. And I will say to everybody that if you want to take less time, there will be no objections from the committee. I'm just saying.
So Representative Reardon, Chair Reardon, members of the committee, my name is Emily Nazarov. I'm with the Department of Education in the Government Legal Affairs section. And we were asked to present on career education and readiness. So we have brought today two of our education specialists from the Department of Education, and we have three presenters that are professionals out in the field who are joining us as well. So I'm going to step back, but if you have any questions or anything, we will be taking notes about information we can get you if you need additional information.
Thanks, Emily.
Chairman Reardon and representatives of the House Committee, for the record, my name is Beth Wiggum. I work with the Oregon Department of Education. I'm the College and Career Readiness and School Counseling Specialist. So today what we wanted to talk to you about was about the K-12 experience that students have, and specifically for the area of school counseling and how that interplays with career readiness and education. And so we have members from the panel that will talk to you today, and please feel free to ask questions. We have some time at the end of each section to even be able to go into more depth if needed. So what today's going to look like for this presentation is the student experience, so comprehensive programming and student standards, career education, information and tools and resources. You'll be able to hear from career educators, what training is like, preparation for school counseling, professional learning opportunities, and also about school counselor's role. Also, we're going to get into some data-driven programs, curricula, and challenges, just some brief discussion on that, as well as innovative programs we'd like to highlight around industry and community connections. So we wanted to start off with Oregon's equity lens, and how school counselors and how we approach the work that we do with students. And really, the equity lens helps to really provide that clear articulation of those shared goals that we have in our state. And this helps to create that culture of the equity. And really, it provides an opportunity for that focus on evaluating services and those opportunities in all areas of education. And also in career education, it's important to address that as well. Equitable access to career information and career-related learning experiences, and also equitable distribution of resources to support students in post-secondary readiness and the planning that goes along with that. So what we wanted to do is show you a quick video hearing from students' perspective of what their needs are. This video was shown at the Oregon Reach Higher Summer Summit 2 summers ago. And this is where this event was to bring together and mobilize around college and career advising supports for all students. And so we brought together teams of K-12 school counselors. There were teachers, administrators, college university advisors, financial aid officers, community mentors, college access volunteers, as well as policy leaders that attended this event. And so for hearing from students, this was a video that we provided at the event.
My name is Helaman Mendoza. I am from Willamette, and my favorite subject is American Studies.
Hi, my name is Dylan, and I'm a first-generation college student. I'm currently attending Willamette High School, and in the future I want to major in green chemistry.
As a kid, you're told that you can be anyone, you can be anything, and it's really exciting.
The future has so many possibilities. You could be like a firefighter, maybe a doctor, construction worker, you could work for a school district as a teacher.
It's like hiking to the top of a mountain and looking out in front of you and seeing so many different paths to take, so many different possibilities, and they're all for me.
You get motivated and you're really excited to just take on the world and go out and go to college and just become an adult. But then it just gets really overwhelming.
All these different paths can be a little intimidating and overwhelming because there's so many different paths to choose from, and I don't know which one is right for me.
I have to apply for college in the first place, and then once you do that, it's like you gotta apply for scholarships, and then it's OSAC and FAFSA and all that stuff, and then you got orientation day, and you gotta know when the first day of school is. And
I don't know what to do for my college search. In fact, I don't even know where I want to go.
What's the difference between a high school counselor or a college advisor? Who do I turn to help once I go to college?
The future suddenly doesn't look like a bunch of possibilities. It seems a lot more like a bunch of obstacles and things that are trying to bring me down, things that I have to get past.
We need more than information. We need navigators, clear direction, and the right tools. We need you.
You are our navigators.
We know that new legislation is making it possible for you to provide even better support.
Many of you have helped others by giving them directions and walking alongside them. We need you to talk to each other and to work with each other to guide us.
We promise to work hard, even when it's scary and overwhelming. We promise to do our best.
It's a new world of options, growth, and potential. Thank you for keeping all the paths open for us.
I go to a lot of dinner auctions, and this is where we usually raise the paddle. Really a great, great video. So.
Thank you. So what we want to do next is really kind of give you an overarching and then just a little in-depth view of what comprehensive school counseling is. And the comprehensive program provides students with academic, socio-emotional learning, career development, community involvement, everything from guidance to supports to direct instruction, group work, and really promotes that holistic and well-rounded approach to supporting and educating students, specifically in these areas is where school counseling programs focus. But, of course, the programs are quite broad in how we approach the work with students. Students need to learn the academic skills necessary to be successful, both now and in post-secondary, with a wide variety of post-secondary options available to them. The socio-emotional learning really speaks to some of those essential 21st century skills that our businesses and community members seek. So everything from communication to the problem solving, being a good member of a team, handling conflict and self-management. So you can see that these things are things that we would want in any profession that we're going into, but really specifically that we're helping students to be able to develop. So career develop learning promotes students' understanding of the world of work. It helps that bridge and intentionality around teachers and educators working with their skill development while connecting students to meaningful career-related learning experiences. So we are working currently to connect Oregon's early learning kindergarten guidelines and standards to Oregon's school counseling mindsets and behaviors, which are our student standards. So we're doing some alignment from early years to K through 12 to really emphasize on how that this is a spectrum of student skills and knowledge that we're helping to develop, and we really want to make sure that we continue to focus on helping students across the spectrum. Also, community involvement is really unique to Oregon. Out of all of the other states, community involvement was one that we were kind of on the forefront with and felt like it was important component to students' academic experience. And so this particular domain really speaks to our statewide commitment to educating our students to becoming contributing members to their local communities as well as globally, our global communities. So these are the school counseling standards that you'll see here on the left-hand side. The school counseling standards incorporate mindsets as well as behaviors that we want students to be able to have and demonstrate, be able to do, and extend beyond those. And they're specific based on national standards, and they've been identified for students in Oregon to help them plan for some of the things that I've been describing. This is actually specifically today focusing on the career domain. So this is just one aspect of our student standards that we're going to highlight and go into just a little more detail about. But it really demonstrates that there's a sequence of skills that schools work with to support students in development across the K-12 continuum. And as I just mentioned, we're starting as early as we can, and the focus will be there on that as well. So in the next slide, we're going to go into a little more detail about that you'll be able to see some more specifics. I know it's really hard to see at the moment.
Chair Reardon and representatives of the House Committee, for the record, my name is Marnie Jewell, and I am at ODE, and I serve in the role of education specialist in the field in the areas of career education as well as CTE licensure. So as you can see here, this is a snapshot of the previous slide, but we knew it was too small to see. So this is an example just in the social skills and just specifically to elementary. We were just showing you quickly how we identify those grade levels for each of those skills that we want students to learn. And then we identify what types of curricula or what types of activities students would need in order to develop those skills. Skills related to the career education and the grades that these should be taught at are what we call the scope and sequence of our work in the career domain. What you'll notice in this one is There is some of the specific examples. Using effective oral and written communication skills would be the first one. Ethical decision making is part of that as well. Collaboration and cooperation, teamwork skills, social maturity, all of these are things we begin teaching at the elementary and continue on through the other grades. But as you will see, this was the Forbes magazine put out an article that was indicated the top 10 skills that employers want to see in their workplace candidates. And we listed just the top five here because we thought you could clearly see that the social skills we were just talking about that we actually start working on in elementary school very closely tie with the skills that employers want to see, such as the ability to work in a team structure, ability to make decisions and solve problems, ability to communicate verbally. Those are the top three, and we begin working on those in the career domain at the elementary and continuing on throughout K-12. So just wanted to show you that we recognize that these skills not only are integral to the success of students in school, but also are clearly lifelong skills that we want students to earn throughout their world of work, and as well as students. So what does career education mean? And then subsequently, what are the types of career experiences that we want students to have? We've developed a career learning continuum, and I don't know if you can read most of these words, but essentially it starts with career awareness on one end of the continuum and moving clear through to career training. As you can see under career awareness, students are learning about work, so they may be experiencing a variety of careers available and the types of and the role of post-secondary education in leading to those careers, and help them to begin thinking about their options. Some of those experiences might include workplace tours, guest speakers, career fairs, take your child to work day. All of those things that we start doing very early on to help students begin exploring the world of work. Moving on, throughout their education, we want them to move into career exploration and more in-depth learning about work. Those experiences might look like informational interviews or job shadows or specifically maybe virtual teleconferences with someone in the industry. Through career preparation, students are starting to learn through work. This might be a school-based enterprise. It might be some sort of service learning with a partner. It might also be a compensated internship that's connected with an industry partner. But what we want to get students to on that far end is that career training. And that's where students are specifically learning for work. And that would basically be that they're training for employment. And some of those experiences might look like internships that are required for entry level into an occupation or an apprenticeship, pre-apprenticeship, on-the-job training or work experience. So where do students get information from? How do they go about getting career information? This looks different at different levels, and you're going to hear a little bit later from our elementary representative. But just broadly speaking, students receive information from school counselors, career advising personnel, maybe classroom teachers for general ed courses, perhaps CTE teachers in high school, where that is an actual designed program of study that uses sequential courses tied to industry standards. Might be through college access professionals such as Aspire or Gear Up. Could be college and career readiness programs. Western Oregon University has a scholars program where they mentor students through middle school, high school, and help them on to bridging into college. It could also be specific programs or courses, AVID programs, are designed to get students career information, college information, making sure that they have the skills to transition into next steps. But it could also be specific programs of study like CTE. They also are able to access through career development classroom materials like books or online materials. We'll talk a little bit more about that. There are different types of activities that we want students to engage in. And those might be just general in the classroom activities that you give to all students. But then we also want to start looking at what is that student's interest? What's that hook that that says, hey, this is an option for you? What are their specific abilities that they have that they could highlight and use within the context of the world of work? There are oftentimes career-specific events like college fairs, industry tours, that sort of thing, or focused activities that that are personalized just for students, connecting them with a specific workplace experience or a job shadow, in order for them to get more in-depth information about what does that mean. Pre-apprenticeship programs are beginning to be built here in Oregon, as well as apprenticeship programs, and that's an additional opportunity for students. And then there's the question about, well, how do students keep it all together and know what to do? And there are many tools, such as online tools. In Oregon, we have Oregon-specific CIS, Career Information System, that travels, has a middle school version, a high school version, travels to the community college, travels to the employment department, where students can capture information and bring it along the way. They're working on an elementary version as well. And then there are also other additional web tools, such as Naviance, where students are able to access similar interest inventories, being able to track their information. But that's that is dependent on the school district and what they choose to use as the vehicle for allowing students to document that and to gather that information together. What I'd like to do now is to share with you, or to introduce you, to Luz Rivera, who is an elementary counselor in the Salem-Keizer School District, and she is at an elementary school, and I am excited that she's able to be here to speak with you today.
Good afternoon.
Could we see if there's any questions on your part before?
Yes, of course.
Are there any questions for Marnie before we go on? I forgot how to do this. Rep. Alonzo.
Thank you, Chair. I do have a question in respect to counselors per students. I know there had been some data around, I think that counselors, I think maybe they have 5 minutes per student because there's so many students in each school district, in each school, and just wanted to know if there are any updates on that. How many counselors work per school? What's the per capita? What per student per counselor ratio? This was several years ago, but I'd like to know more updates now where we're at statewide.
Go ahead. Chairman Reardon and Representative Alonzo Leon, there is some work that we're going to be doing with the State Board of Education specifically to address this. There's some inequities around school counselors that there's not enough to help students. And so currently, I don't have the numbers. I can get the numbers of what the ratios are. As of last school year, the ratios were just over 600 to one student. Yeah. So, student to counselor ratio.
Yeah. Follow up, Chair. So I would like to get where we're at now and where we would like to be and what's the plan to getting there. That would be really helpful.
Absolutely.
For me.
We'll make a note of that. And
thank you.
Rep. Shulman.
Thanks, Chair Reardon. I would just like to follow up with that, too, to be able to say that I had the opportunity as a school board member to go around to several schools and talk to, like, a student speak events where it was just students in the room with the superintendent and a board member. And that was the number one concern of high school students is their counselor-to-student ratio. Not only do they have these career, needs and this help, like, oh, my gosh, I've got to get it all figured out, they also have the social and emotional needs that are very tough as well. So I really concur with your thoughts, too, and it's imperative that we get that that kind of assistance to our students.
Would I be accurate in my recollection that the recommended ratio is more like 250-1?
It is. Chairman Reardon. It is recommended by the ASCA National Association that it's 250-1.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Yeah. With me.
Thank you, Chair. A couple years ago, there was a conference at Central Oregon Community College about counseling, as very informative and everything. I like everything you're talking about here. It's very, very exciting programs, high school internships and things like that. But I would concur with my colleagues on the committee that my visit to Ben Lapine High School, that the counselors say that 20% of their work is this, and 80% is social needs and counseling on social needs. I was scared to death when I found out that how many high school students are on death or suicide watch. And so I've worked for several sessions, and we had some success this last session in approaching school nurses, making that ratio, but this ratio is the same thing that we're going to have to look at and be sure that we have a plan. I don't see anyone. Is anyone in here from ODE besides the count, but not the bigwigs or the lobbyists, but legislative people? I think this should be on our radar scope, and we need to but we need to start working on this ratio that we've gone, you know, from, like I said, the school nurses, but to help our economy and help these kids get into society and succeed. We need to provide. This is great, but I'm just afraid there's not enough of you. Thank you.
I don't think you'll get any argument from them.
Chairman Reardon and Representative Wisnett, I think you really bring out, highlight two important areas that we want to begin to really try to focus in on. So that's the student counselor ratio, as well as the school counselor role. So you were referring to the 80-20 percentage of our time for school counselors. And we'll get to that a little bit later in the presentation, but that is another area that we will need to be looking at in order to be able to help all students.
Will you be talking about the new framework at some point?
Yes.
Okay.
Briefly.
Good afternoon, Chairman Reardon and House Representative Medmers. My name is Luce Rivera for the record, and my role is elementary school counselor for the Salem-Keizer School District. I'm currently placed at Myers Elementary School, which has approximately 539 students. I am the only school counselor, and I've been there, and this is my fourth year. In that program, we also carry a dual language classroom that is tracked from K through fifth grade. We have one of those, and those students stay as a community classroom their entire time at elementary. So as we begin, I want to address why we should start this conversation early. Why at the elementary school level? School counselors are a vital part of creating college and career-bound cultures. We are led by guiding principles, professional standards, and evidence-based practices, and they inform our work. And one of these is the Oregon Common Core State Standards, in addition to those mentioned by my colleagues. We teach, we lead, we analyze, and we collaborate. We design programs. And we do all of this to help elementary school children grow up to be as healthy and as stable and responsible as possible in their future. We need to begin conversations early to provide students the time and best opportunity possible to vision what that future is going to look like and to help them become self-sufficient and contributing members of society. We need to also begin the conversation early because not all students come prepared when they enter preschool or elementary school. We have to identify these students, and we have to work on eliminating barriers to learning as soon as possible because learning takes time, learning is cumulative, and once they get out of elementary school and into middle and high school, it is very, very difficult to catch up. As we shape college and career-bound cultures, we do so by working side by side with families. And they need the help to prepare, to plan, to understand and execute this direction. They need elementary counselors in their lives. Going on to cultural responsiveness. Our role as school counselors is to assist in removing any barriers to learning, and that exists in all three areas: academics, personal, social, and career. School counselors promote equity and cultural responsiveness. We do so because we have diverse student populations. There's no question about that. Among them are also students who experience poverty, trauma, and or come from an underrepresented group, ethnic, racial, whichever category you choose to think of. We address cultural responsiveness by serving and working with leadership teams. We are assessing the status of student groups as well as individual student needs. And we provide interventions to create positive change, promote inclusive language, create a culturally rich school climate. And we feature culturally relevant and inclusive lessons, and so much more. We know that families who possess differences due to culture and lack of equity simply have fewer opportunities overall. By starting the conversation early and recognizing their essential needs, well, the reality is that's what our goal is. That's what our job is. You heard in that video, we're navigators. We have to be passionate. We have to instill that in not just the students, but in their families as well. When we can teach them to see it, they can become it. Whatever it is that is going to mean for them, we don't get to choose that. They get to choose that. We get to help inform them. As we move on to foundational skills, you've heard quite a lot about the things that are being done in our discipline, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time belaboring that. These are just some of the foundational skills that I wanted you to see. Elementary school is prime time. It doesn't come after middle. It doesn't come after high school. We're it. We're the starting point. But for many years, we have taken a back seat, and we can't do that anymore. We have to make the emphasis count. Your question, Representative Alonso, about our ratio, that's very exciting to me. Very few people actually know and understand that, not even families. I really need to emphasize, if we want to make this work, we got to hit that. Continuing, beginning time in elementary school is really exploratory. It's about helping them to connect, finding out who they are. They learn about themselves. They learn about the roles, careers that other caring adults in their lives are engaged in. And they have experiences that help them see what jobs look like, along with how to do the best job possible. Elementary school counselors create a solid foundation by introducing students to college and career, related terminology, which in turn reinforces the creation of a college and career-bound culture. We tell them and we give them the high expectation. You're going to graduate. When I give you this certificate for bucket filler, I'm shaking your hand, and when you graduate, this is what the principal does for you. This is your diploma, except it's a bucket filler now. You're going to get that diploma. That's how it begins. When students need support to address concerns over their progress with foundational skills, we work independently as well as part of a team to ensure that we're formulating plans that will help to address the concerns, whether they are academic and or behavioral. We provide positive interventions and supports to address the need and monitor to adjust as needed. If a student does not meet key benchmarks as determined by third grade, we don't have the luxury to quit. We have to come back fourth grade and say, hey, you gotta do this, and we're going to work on it, and this is the plan for you. Are you buying in? What can we get you to do to buy in? Because it's not too late. Because of the scope of work that we do, students are exposed to many different options available to them, from post-secondary paths to potential career goals. Let's move on to the next one, please. Oh, sorry. You were already there. I apologize. Strategies. So, we have an office, the National Office for School Counseling Advocacy, we know as NOSCA. NOSCA has provided a guiding document at all levels for elementary, middle, and high school. And they've outlined 8 components. We have 6 components that they attribute specifically to elementary school. And of those 6, I just want to highlight a couple. We need students to aspire. That's college aspiration. We need them to do that because it is creating an active and productive engagement in their day-to-day school life. We demonstrate this by looking at the key data that's considering their attendance, their discipline, and their promotion. Another area under the NOSCA guideline is addressing academic planning. So we have to pay close attention to progress by determining, are they meeting their grade level benchmarks? Are they there? And if they're not there, what is the obstacle? We also invest in enrichment and extracurricular activity, as well as create opportunities for student leadership under these activities. If we don't do that, we really aren't giving them all of the support that they need. That passion that those kids were talking about that they needed at that high school level or at that college level, that starts here. The other areas in which we utilize strategies to make impact is with social-emotional learning, especially in areas of communication, conflict resolution, to support emotional health and positive development. Last 2 years, I've taught all of my students the number one thing that employers want is they want to know that you can get along on a team. They're not interested in whether or not you can really do the skill. They want to know, can you get along? Can you talk? Can you be social and appropriate? That's a beginning point of conversation. College and career activities are also important at every grade level, and fostering and building knowledge and confidence in their pursuit to learning. And finally, parent engagement activities that will help address questions, concerns, and share key information. That's got to be there too, because Lord knows they need that help. They don't always know. And sometimes what they think they know turns out to be inaccurate. It's not true. The biggest support that elementary students need is a framework to guide their career exploration and to be present in the delivery of that framework at the elementary school level. They also need me, and they need a counselor that can be there for them. I cannot do what 539 students need me to do. But you know what? I know how to skin a cat, and I'm going to get at it. And I miss somebody today, but they'll be at my door tomorrow. I know that. Because their teacher will find them, they'll say, yep, you got to go to Miss Luce. And that's where we begin again. I wish I could tell you that my life as a school counselor is perfect. It's not. All of the wonderful professional standards, practices, and guidelines we have are beautiful. But life is not perfect, and neither are the lives of our students. I hope that when you sit back and consider some of the work that needs to be done, you'll think about that. Thank you very much.
Questions? Rep. Lynn?
Thank you, Chair Reardon. Thank you for your presentation. I wanted to kind of echo some of the things that you talked about. I have a 7-year-old, I think he is now, and we were doing career counseling this morning, and I asked him, you know, what he wanted to be, and he was like, something that doesn't work all night. And I was like, what does that mean? He says, you know, not a policeman, not a firefighter, not a representative.
You're safe.
And he said, a scientist. And so I was like, okay, all right, well, we'll go from there. But when you talked about seeing is believing, I think that that's a very important aspect of it. And it's important for us to build that structure in to make sure that all kids have opportunities to see people in the community that, especially for minority kids, look like them. That's very important. And the second part is to make sure that they just have access to walk in and ask questions anywhere someone is working. And so the second part I wanted to talk about is I'm an employer. So not only do we want kids to be able to work on a team, can I get them to show up?
Yes.
On time?
Yes.
Read a schedule?
Yes.
And communicate when you can't be there. So those are the things, that's kind of like the real world feedback. Right now, like today, 2017, November, it's just, can you show up? Because we're not getting kids doing that. So all of the skills that you all are teaching and going over with the kids are super important. And I think that we could do a better job of involving small businesses in the employment process and internship process, because right now if you want to hire a teenager, 14 or 15 year old, they can work 4 to 7 Monday through Friday. That's not very practical. I think they can work weekends. It's a disincentive to hire kids until they're 16, and I've heard that in a variety of places in the community. So those are my comments.
Great, thank you. Rep. Angeline.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. You know, one of the things, as a former GED administrator for the state, one of the challenges that I experienced is knowing that we have one of the worst graduation rates in the country. And that makes me extremely sad and a bit frustrated, frankly. And I know that we have a lot of work to do. So I appreciate the successful elementary strategies and that we have parent engagement in there, because that is critical for many of our families. I remember as a child, you know, coming to this country as an immigrant, my parents didn't know how to navigate the education system. And so I had to learn on my own. And I would, you know, at school have counselors and teachers tell me, you know, Teresa, you're going to go to college someday. So they planted that seed in me. But I would go home and my parents would say, we can't afford it. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, that was the communication I had with them. And it wasn't until a parent engagement program where my parents got invited and they got to tour U of O and they got to hear from, you know, other folks about my own potential. So I love that parent engagement is such an important aspect of helping young people be successful, because when they get to eighth grade and ninth grade, that's when we lose them. And we need to figure out how to, even if we lose them, how can we re-engage them back? And how can we connect them to the GED program, for example? I think that that's an area that we can do a better job working together. So K-12 system with the HEC and the GED program, we need to work a little bit better in that area and really emphasizing the parent engagement. But then also, I think what's really critical is helping young people understand their full potential and thinking about education, post-education globally, that we don't minimize aspects of career fields, but that we encourage career technical programs, apprenticeship programs, all the way to four-year programs. And, you know, I talk to young people all the time, and I think that some of them tell me, nobody told me that I was college material, or nobody told me that I could go into an apprenticeship program. And so just thinking about that broadly and really helping young people think about their own potential in a more global way, I think it's an important aspect to think about. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Yeah, Rep. Noble?
It's more of a comment. Ms. Luce, is that how you say it? I really appreciate the passion and the energy you bring to this, and I could only hope that every child in this state has a counselor that reflect your values.
Thank you, Representative Noble. And I would like to add a comment hearing you all speak, because I think it's an important thing to illustrate. So I'm going to stand up because I recognize that I've had my back to the room, but I think that you all are here and you're part of this conversation. And as you've heard, my conversation has triggered some thoughts about children and their lives, some of their own experiences, and I'm wondering that that's probably happening for some of you. But I'm going to tell you who my elementary school counselor was. Her name was Dolores Morales Sanes. She was my grandmother. I didn't have an elementary school counselor. And when I went to middle school, I had a counselor that I did not know. The only reason I knew that person was because one of my friends was threatening suicide. I was crying, I went to tell him, and that was it. Now, I was a student that didn't know how to read very well. So I started in my home school, I'm from St. Thomas, U.S. Virgin Islands, in a reading group for low readers. I never dreamed or imagined that I would be this person, but someone else did, and that speaks to relationship. Nothing that we do happens without a relationship, and I can't tell you how many adults I encounter in and outside of education who struggle to do that very thing. And all you have to do is ask questions and talk. But in your roles, I'm very excited. You have no idea. I came in here having a really tough month, thinking about all of the students that I'm still trying to reach and trying to impact that I know I will get. I'm going to get them. But to know that you guys have these questions on your mind, it is inspiring me. It is the actual vitamin shot that I needed in the arm today. Make no mistake about it. And I want to thank ODE for inviting me to the conversation.
Well, thank you for that. I think you've shown us what the best counseling can be and inspiring us too, at least. So were there other, I thought I saw another hand up. Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you again for your presentation and for your work with children directly. That's a skill I don't have, so I appreciate that. Although working in the legislature, it comes in handy. No, I'm just teasing.
Representative.
So I guess my question goes, in your testimony, I want to make sure that I understood this correctly. You said something around the line that when students don't learn or get their elementary years correct, it's almost impossible to catch up in their...
When they fall behind.
And what do you mean by that, falling behind? Is that...
Some students, and thank you for the question, Representative Reschke.
Yes.
What I mean by that is if a child comes into school and they're behind, mm-hmm. and we're working diligently for that third grade proficiency. We need them to be reading by third grade. If we can't get that and we continue to work on it for fourth and fifth grade, mm-hmm. by the time we finish and they get into middle school, it's like a black hole. We start to lose them there because they lose hope.
Right.
And there it comes my conversation around programs that have been mentioned, like AVID, like the relationship of the people that they're going to connect with in their next school.
Okay, follow up then?
Please.
Okay, so I just wanted to make sure I understood that, that it's mostly an academic falling behind that you're describing. And so when I went to school in the dark ages, way back when, in the 20th century, if somebody didn't meet academic for third grade, guess what they did? They went back and did third grade again.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, why are we forcing students that aren't academically prepared for middle school, why are we pushing them through the system like that?
Representative,
and it might not be for you, it might be for everybody.
I just want to say thank you for the question, because it's a question that I have.
Okay.
And I would say to you that I know what the policy decisions are and what people have told me about that. We are not holding students back. There are great exceptions to when that changes. And it entails, at least in my district, and I'll let others speak to this, a process where they have to go for an appeal.
You're okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the presentation. One of the things that I think about, at least in terms of high school counseling, that I'm hearing in part of my community is that high school counselors are maybe not doing as good as a job as we'd like at connecting people to apprenticeship opportunities, as fairly presenting that as an option for students. And so my question is really, a response to that, and what are we doing to make sure that apprenticeship opportunities, particularly in the trades, are being fairly represented? And also, like, do we collect data about, you know, how many students are going into apprenticeships or some of the different paths out of high school?
So, Chair Reardon and Representative Fahey, I think you'll find we have a second portion that actually talks about more high school experiences. And
pause.
I think if we get through that, that may actually answer a number of those questions related to high school. But I do want to come back to that data piece and apprenticeship, and which isn't necessarily addressed in this, and we can get you that information. So I do know that in terms of time, our on-the-phone participant has to leave in just a couple minutes for another meeting. So if we can include her in what she's doing to help counselors connect with those industry things, I think that might start shedding some light on that. So we're going to jump forward in our in our slides, so forgive us for the messiness for just a minute.
You're doing great.
So I will introduce you virtually to Brooke Nova, who is in the Hillsborough School District and works with College and Career Readiness. Brooke.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon.
Hi, Brooke.
Hi.
Thank you for being here today.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Chairman Reardon and representatives of House Committee, for the record, my name is Brooke Nova, and I'm the coordinator of Career and College Pathways for the Hillsborough School District. And it has brought such joy to my heart just listening to the conversations taking place so far, and I wish I could be there in person. I also have to give a special hello to Representative Solomon, who is near and dear to my heart. So hello to you.
She's waving.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about what we're doing in Hillsborough in terms of career and college readiness and the support of high school counselors, as well as K-12 counselors as well. So I think you're on my slide that says, I hope, connecting in the metro area college and career pathways.
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Great. Okay. So this is my fourth year in my position and is also the fourth year of this structure that we have created. Really the focus of how do we connect community, counselors, career and technical education teachers, community partners, in the work. I really, truly believe, and in our school district, we believe it really takes all hands on deck to support our students and to make sure that we have clear and viable pathways for our students. So in that, that means bringing everyone together in efforts around this work. Luckily, also Representative Solomon is on the steering committee, so she can speak to this as well. But the focus of that work is how do we support our students in the pre-K to 12 journey, providing them those experiences around being aware, eligible, and prepared in this work. So when we formed the steering committee, it's in three groups. One is around dual credit. One is around community and communication, which is where our counselors work is. And then the other one is in career learning areas, which is around the six recognized career technical education pathways. So when we bring together our work group, that is the focus. And the reason why we bring everyone together is to make sure that we're all are on the same page. Because it really takes the work of the school counselors that I think the counselor before me just spoke about. I think it takes, I know Sherry's going to speak, around the work of our post-secondary partners and our dual credit partners. It takes the work of the teachers and administrators, our industry partners, and our community nonprofits to really have this clear vision and purpose. For us, we have indicated metrics around this work. We've been measuring those since we've created this this structure. We have noticed that because of our collective efforts, the dual credit, our FAFSA rates, our internship participation rates, the amount of money that students are saving because of their dual credit participation have significantly gone up. For example, in dual credit has gone up 54% in the last 3 years. Our FAFSA rates have gone up by 29% in the last 3 years. Our internships have gone up by 33%. And the amount of savings because of dual credit has gone up 125%. But this is really because of our wraparound support and services and having that clear direction and purposeful planning that it takes everyone. So when you look at that piece around the steering committee, that's the work that we discuss, that we are focused on, that all hands on deck of supporting our students. In terms of the counseling piece, I'm very fortunate to work with and support wonderful counselors who have helped to design lessons that start in kindergarten at every elementary, at every middle school, and every high school. And because of that work, making sure that every student has those guidance lessons that are given by counselors, coming into partnership with that teacher, either elementary support or through their middle school teachers and their high school teachers, to be able to complement and speak to skills around career and college readiness, and then that connection from the classroom to community. So if, let's say, it's first grade farm unit, a counselor giving a career and college lesson, but then also being able to tie it to the farm unit, and then saying, okay, now out of the six recognized career pathways, it ties to agriculture, food, and natural resources class. Let's talk about what types of careers are out there. We're also very fortunate to have a strong support with our city and our Chamber of Commerce. They're able to provide guest speakers and hands-on learning opportunities for our students. So as we've had this focus around internships and the increase in internships, they have really been a big supporter of that too. Let me go back to the presentation. So in terms of also the professional development, when we go to the regional or the national career and technical education conference, for example, we're bringing our counselors with us. When we have Northwest Promise or Willamette Promise PLCs, our counselors are involved in that because they are the hub of communication. So they really need to understand and know career and technical education, pathways, dual credit, how do I communicate that out in a purposeful way for students to be able to connect the dots and transition on to post-secondary ed or to an apprenticeship or to the world of work. Someone asked the question about collecting data. We collect data in all of those aspects, and we celebrate all of those. Because going on for career in college, we need to celebrate what students decide, but we also need to know and collect data around where are they going, what are they doing. So in terms of that professional development, I think it's always that wraparound of making sure that one specific group aren't the gatekeepers of the information, but it's a collective learning experience for all. I noticed that another slide, someone's going to speak about externships. We've done that in Hillsborough before, where we had a high school counselor, a career and technical education teacher, and a core content teacher going out into industry during the summer. That's been a great experience because, once again, they're together, they're learning, they're collaborating, they're all on the same page to deliver that information for the best student experience. I'm going on to the next slide, building student support opportunities. You know, what we did at the beginning of last year is we looked at highway tie demand in our area. And when we did that, we brought that to the steering committee in the fall, and we said, here are the highway tie demand careers and opportunities in Hillsborough in the metro area. What do we need to do to make sure we get students out into those careers equipped with this information? That's how we have developed more career pathways. Since I've taken this position, we've gone from 19 career pathways, and next year we'll have 28 or 29 pathways. But that really is the support around the steering committee, the work of the counselors and the career and technical education teachers and the building administrators saying, you know, we know that this is our up-and-coming trends. We need to make sure our students are equipped and ready for those jobs, and how do we build those pathways for our students. So really looking at that highway tie demand and being able to speak to that is really important, especially in the work of counseling. And to be able to develop that, starting to have that language and even understanding the pathways really does start in that elementary work, in that becoming aware area. And then when we move to the eligibility area of how, if I'm starting to become aware of different pathways and what I'm connected to, how do I become eligible for that career or that post-secondary piece that happens more in the middle school? And then prepare means I'm ready to transition now from that high school component on to the next step. Something else that we did, I've been taking notes as I've been hearing all this, is 3 years ago, the board, thank you so much, passed an internship elective credit as well as a community service learning elective credit. So we're actually able to embed hands-on learning experiences during the school day. And I heard that was a question earlier. So that really does help students to be able to connect with their learning either in a core content or a career pathway in industry during their school day. And that has been definitely a help, because it is hard if a business is closing at 5 o'clock and a student is getting out 3:30. That's a really difficult thing. So to be able to, I think creatively about how to best support our students in that transition from classroom to community is huge. I think I've shared a lot, and it's really, it's hard not to see everyone in the room. So I'm going to pause for a second and take any questions that anyone may have.
Any questions? Just one. This is Chair Reardon. And thank you so much for being here in whatever form. And Rep Solomon is really tickled. You just won a lot of points with her.
She was hard.
So we had a question earlier about, you know, what happens if a student doesn't, you know, make it at grade 3, and, you know, should we hold them back or, you know, whatever, and the impact of that. So my question before you leave and get off the hook, and this could be for any of you, so why do we have grades?
So I'm going to share just a little bit of, there's a very big focus right now on knowing every student by name, strength, and need. Mm-hmm. That's something that we share a lot in our district, is how do we know every student by name, strength, and need, no matter what grade that you are in? And I think part of that is being able to support that student academically, personal, social, career, whatever, and how do you know those students? So I might not be able to speak about transitioning a student from third to fourth grade, but I think what we've been really focused on is how do we support our students to know and to be able to support them when they're transitioning on to different grades. And that really does take that strong support of not only their counselor, but their teacher and the community member. So I don't, I think that's a philosophical question of why do we have grades, and that might be a better one for Marnie or for Beth, but I just think really being able to support our students and where they're at is very important.
I think that's the bottom line for all of us, is try to figure out where they're at and how to meet them so they get, what they need to be successful at whatever level.
100%. Something else that I, and I love Representative Zalman's is true, that I deal with, it was very important for that student connection last year as she was a school board member, to hear students say, we need more support. Mm-hmm. And what we've done and we're still continuing to work on is, around that idea of knowing every student by name, strength, and need, we invested part of our Measure 98 funds to create at the high school level a student support and wellness counselor. So to be able to support that student in their social-emotional needs, and that's their focus, that has really helped. Someone also talked about the GED process and reconnecting students just to school. That has been a focus in that position as well. We've seen a surge of students re-engaged, and our GED numbers are going up in terms of enrollment in that program, and that has been a focus of that student support and wellness counselor. If we have lost any student, let's get them back in school and really figure out what's best for them. Let's also wrap around our students in a different way, and so investing in that role of the school counselor, I think, has been a smart move at our high school level. I'd love to have that at our other grade levels as well. We know there's such a need for trauma-informed care practices in elementary and middle as well, but with Measure 98, it's an investment in high school, but that's been huge, I think, to support students. So, I think when we talk about really knowing every student, it does take an investment of people and resources and the commitment of really wrapping around each student.
My last question, at least while you're here, I understand you need to run off, but do you think in all of the work that you do, or any of you at the dais or at the panel, think that there is a bias toward one direction or the other, toward careers versus college, or is the information prepared mm-hmm. and presented in an objective way? Yes.
I'll say something, and I bet my colleagues will join in. It's been a really interesting pendulum. There was this time of career tech ed was the way, and vocational tech, and then I think there was the pendulum swing of it's 4-year or nothing. And I feel like, at least in Hillsboro, we are really, that's why it's career and college pathways, is really that focus around, let's make sure that we're identifying your career interests and then discussing the post-secondary route to get you to your dreams. Yeah. And that, in terms of our classroom guidance, is something that's very focused on, is let's talk about the difference between an apprenticeship, trade school, 2-year community college, a 4-year route. Mm-hmm. I think that we're still moving that pendulum back to a balance. I think there's still the pressure of students feeling like they have to go to a 4-year school mm-hmm. or nothing, but that is a clear focus that we're helping to support our educators with. I think that's the growth of more career and technical education programs in our district. I think that was it's a big focus around Measure 98 passing, is that career and technical education focus. So I think it takes those efforts, though, of that communication, especially from counselors, that what you choose to do in terms of transitioning from high school to the next step, it's really making a smart plan and a purposeful plan to get you to where you want to go in life. And it is wonderful if that's an apprenticeship. It's wonderful if it's a 1-year certificate that transitions you to a 2-year community college degree, but it's really continuing to have that clear message and communication in a school. And I think we're still moving that pendulum back, because I know students still feel like, if I don't go to a four-year school, I'm not as
successful,
smart, I'm not as successful as others, and that's definitely not true.
Great comments. Thank you so much. Ms. Rivera?
Thank you, Representative Reardon, and thank you for the question. So I say yes. I hear often from others internally in our building from some people who believe that, yeah, college is the most important thing, and that comes from family of origin values. And we have to break that. We have to advocate for a different perspective, and that's what school counselors do. We have to look at even that the kid that has an identified special education plan, is in an emotional growth classroom, can actually become a person that holds a job. We have to have that vision, because if we don't have it, they're not going to get that. They're not going to see it. So it is incumbent upon us to do that. So thank you for the question.
You're welcome. Thank you. Rep. Solman.
Thanks, Chair Reardon. I would also say I'm just extremely proud of the work that's been doing in Hillsboro, but it really is a collaborative movement, and as Brooke had mentioned. And before we have this beautiful model in our career and college pathways, and has this tree with all these branches of human resources. And I consistently would ask, where's your trade branch? Mm-hmm. And Brooke would probably say, yes, she did. Where's the trade branch? Because we talked about where are our apprenticeships and things like that. And it's not just because Hillsboro was looking at that. That was a push all across the state. Everywhere. It's where you go into college, where you go into college. I mean, my two boys felt it. My oldest, he went the college pathway. He knew what he wanted. My youngest didn't, and he felt the pressure of like, oh my gosh, I don't know what I want to do, and figure that out. He went the trade route. And so I think we are, it's fabulous to hear that our counselors, I just really do continually get concerned about workload. And I, you know, love the idea that we are looking at student support wellness counselors and things, because we have to look at all those needs. And our students are coming, I think you had said, they're coming not perfect. They've got issues. They've got things that they baggage they're carrying. So thank you all for all your work and passion.
Ripple on to Leon.
Yes, thank you for the comments. I would like to add in that I just appreciate all that the counselors are doing and understanding the workload that they have and the student numbers that they have. But it's imperative that that the whole entire education system, the support staff, the teachers themselves, the teacher aides, that we all talk about education globally. About you know, there's opportunity for you to go to an apprenticeship program. Here are all the options for you. Here's a career technical program. Here are all the options for you. Here are all the 2-year programs. Here are the options for you. All the way to 4-year degree programs. And I think it really takes all of us talking about it, not just the counselors, because they are, you know, if they tell a student, here's an amazing technical career program for you, and the student's excited, leaves the room or the office just thrilled about this new opportunity, talks to a teacher, and the teacher says, but you can do better than that. Mm-hmm. And that is very deflating to a student who aspires to become an expert in whatever it is that they want to become, and to have another educator take that away from them, which is really not fair, right? So, you know, we all need to get on the bandwagon of all working together and talking the same language, so that we don't discourage students from their dreams, but rather we encourage them and we support their pathways and getting there. Because otherwise, we're going to lose them. They're going to drop out, and it's harder to get them back in.
So I think for a lot of those reasons that you've articulated so well is, I think we're going to hear that counseling really is a team sport. Yeah. It's not as I guiltily recall being a teacher and thinking if I had problem kids, I'd just send them to the counselor. That's why I'm trying to make it up to them now.
Thank you.
They've got a bigger job than that.
Yes.
So we have about 15 or 20 minutes left, and so carry on.
Thank you. So thank you, Brooke. And so we're going to just, forgive us, we're going to go back and just briefly touch base on something we wanted to cover earlier on to lay some foundational knowledge regarding what the actual training of school counselors is and what knowledge and expertise they bring to this. And so the pre-service programs in the state of Oregon cover a number of topics such as foundations in school counseling, group theory, family, individual counseling. But there are specific courses in career development in every single school counseling prep program. And sometimes people don't realize that there's actual formal training that school counselors get in career development. Also, classroom instruction and management, they do a teaching practicum. Action research using data, as well as their practicum experiences and supervision. Recently, the Chief Ed Office conducted a community engagement session, and the report that they came out with highlighted that the school counselor's role is seen as three separate jobs, mental or behavioral health, or college and career advising, or scheduling and academics, when in reality, school counselors operate in all three arenas. And we try to really focus the time into 80% direct service to students and 20% of time indirect, supporting the system to help make address barriers, make systems better, collaborate, communicate, professional development. And so what is it that they actually do? They implement, facilitate comprehensive programming, providing curriculum, data collection and analysis, facilitation of the standards in each of these areas. It doesn't mean they're the only person who does it. You've heard the ratios. They can't do that, but they do facilitate that that coordination of those efforts in their schools and in their districts. And also professional development in order to stay up to date in all of these arenas, most current in all of these arenas. So what are the challenges? Mm-hmm. We've touched base on a few of those. Student priorities and needs, such as social, emotional, and mental health needs, high levels of crisis response services in some buildings. But systemically, there's also the perception of the role of counseling. We just talked about that. And the belief in what school counselors do or other duties that get assigned because of the lack of understanding about what their expertise is. We've talked about the ratios and the issues involved with them. Rural areas particularly and their access to counseling FTE. But one of the things we haven't talked about, and I'm excited for Sherry to talk to you, is actually PD opportunities. Sometimes the timing of those PD opportunities can be a barrier as well, because on one hand, administrators don't want school counselors to leave the building during a school day because what if something bad happens? And on the other hand, when are they supposed to get all of this up-to-date knowledge in all of these areas in order to provide the best services possible? So I just lay that as a foundation because some of the work that's happening out in the field is really seeking to address some of these, and we thought you would be excited to hear some of the solutions. There are professional development opportunities, educational opportunities such as the Oregon School Counselor Association, state conferences and regional trainings. The CCR Alliance Academy provides coursework for counselors, administrators, and educators as well. The American School Counseling Association has specific courses for school counselors. There are webinars, externships with industry partners. You're going to hear about that. We had the Reach Higher Summit that we talked about as well. And there are listservs, networks, and online courses. But what we want you to hear about finally from Sherry is some of the innovative ways that we're connecting school counselors with industry partners.
Thank you. Chairman Reardon and representatives of the House Committee, for the record, my name is Sherry Clark, and I am the manager of career and college for Willamette Promise at the WESD, and I serve the Northwest Regional Area, the WESD area, and the Lane ESD area. Mm-hmm. So I have a little bit of a caseload myself. But I love what I do. I actually come from the college as an advisor, so sometimes the K-12 world is a little different for me, but I got to see how students struggled in that transition, and I think it is what brings my passion to the table when I'm thinking about what students need. And I have been very blessed to just collaborate with a lot of wonderful people around this state that that are very interested in helping students to move forward. So one of my roles is to provide the professional development for those areas, meaning the geographic areas. And so I provide two professional developments in fall, two winter, two spring. In the fall, they're basically the same event. It gives counselors two chances to choose which day they might have a chance of getting out of the building. And we also offer that professional development in businesses. So our last one last week was actually at Perlo Construction. So I'm getting our counselors out of the office, and not just counselors, Aspire, anybody that's College and Career Access, CSOCs, thank you for, so graduation coaches, some of the different specialization workers that are working within our schools, helping students also to make those decisions. So by bringing them out to industry, we bring them some relevance about what's really out there. This time in construction, they got to meet in the Innovation Hub at Perlo Construction, and that in itself was an eye-opening event for counselors to think about what construction is really about, and to see the direct service as well as the indirect service within that, and to see that they have marketers, they have accountants, they have, right? Mm-hmm. They have all of these different kinds of things. So I'm helping to open and expose them to that information. One of the other pieces that's critical to us is we work with a lot of the organizations out there that are helping us with things like FAFSA and Oregon Promise and so forth. So OSAC, CIS, College Board, we invite them to every professional development. In the beginning, it took them about 45 minutes at each one of those to help us to figure out what was going on. We're down to about 15 minutes of updates now because we've gotten on the same page. We're learning the same language. We're becoming more confident in our message, and that translates to our students being more confident in what they're hearing from us. We also, Marnie comes, Beth comes, they share about the different frameworks and things that are moving along, so we're getting timely information and changes out to counselors just right away, which is really neat. I think one of the things that was happening in the past is that it was almost like the telephone game to get the information you needed as a counselor to give students. So it didn't always sound the same. And then kids kind of lose confidence if they're not hearing a message that's really clear and ringing true to them. If we have confusion, they will have confusion. Through Senate Bill 418, we have the CCR, which College Career Readiness Alliance Academy, and so we facilitate online courses, and I'm privileged to be able to facilitate some of those courses. And it's really neat to see three or four counselors who are at a school together sit down and say, this is the first time we've talked about our role, talked about what we're doing and how we're moving forward, and also figuring out what the strengths between them are and how they move together to impact their students. And it's shocking sometimes to think that's the first time you've had to do that, but it's also exciting to think that they've had those opportunities. The other thing that I didn't anticipate when we started this professional development was that our partners also realized where their communication was falling short. I remember a meeting in which OSAC came in and said, we've got this new plan, we're doing it this way, and not one counselor in the room had heard anything about it. And then they said, oh, it's because we sent the information to registrars, we forgot to send you the, you know. So that was really helpful for them to be able to go back and go, gosh, I guess what we're trying to communicate is falling short. And so they began to collaborate on things in a much greater way. We have since then started taking all of the information they received from handouts, presentations. It's all on our WESD website, linked to each speaker. So if they want to go back and see somebody who presented, what those materials were, if there's a video, anything, they can go back and look at the fall event and pull up that particular individual that spoke and recall their information. One of the most exciting things for me, moving to the next slide, is expos, educator externships, and engagement. And I want to talk briefly about that. I was invited, and I think it was one of my lucky days, we all have those, where I got invited to a coalition of the Associated General Contractors, and they said, how do we get into schools? And someone next to me hit me with their elbow and said, that's you. And I said, okay. So I really call it my lucky day because it's a very collaborative group of individuals from around the state of Oregon that have said, how do we help students understand what all their opportunities are? And from that, we decided that we would start doing more expos or opportunities for students to meet with industry closer to home for them. So we brought one to Polk County. We brought one to Yamhill. We started bringing them to a place that felt like home for them. I love what they do in Portland. Don't get me wrong. It's a great expo and great event. But I watched students, and it didn't feel like home. A lot of them are wearing their Romeos, and they just feel much better at the Polk County Fairground. And it just feels like something that's more real to them. So we started doing that, but we started assessing what was happening, and we said, we're not getting where we want to go. We're getting kids experiences, but we're still not where we want to go. We're not creating the pathway that we want to create. So the coalition sat down and decided to do what we call an educator externship. We took 27 teachers, counselors, middle school, high school, all the above, out into the industry for 8 days last year, and they learned everything from the back office to being out on a construction site to what is construction that is not a building look like with Sladen Construction. They looked at all those kinds of things. One teacher who was very excited was a culinary teacher who found out that cement is a recipe and that asphalt is a recipe. And she said, I have a lot of students in my class, or they're probably there just for the cookies, but I'm going to be able to talk to them about what happens when you double the recipe, what happens when you cut it in half. And so we brought that relevance back into the classroom so when they're teaching, they can say, I saw this skill being used out in the industry. Yeah. They also have great partnerships with all of these companies. We did a bus tour through Knife River. Who would have thought? I didn't have any idea that we'd do a bus tour. And so they're building these relationships. They're bringing that relevance back to their classroom about the different things that they're doing and what it means. I had industry partners who met with teachers, and first they said, let's do some pre-apprenticeships, which would be great. But when it really came down to it, the teacher said, I'm teaching about ohms in my science class, but I'm teaching it just in theory. If I could get some materials, I could teach that in practice. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, Independent Electrical Training Center here in Salem said, we will get you some things from our vendors. We will get you the things that you need to be able to do that and to build it into something that's hands-on for the students. So it was really exciting to see how, again, we're just putting that web way out there, and we're pulling everyone together to make this work happen. The educators that came out had to build a lesson plan that is now on the web for other teachers to see, and they had to do a presentation as well. And we're looking forward to doing more and more of those kinds of things. Industry partners have been invaluable to us, and we are just amazed at how much they want to participate and they want to help our teachers to do the things that they need to do. And it was critical because, as you've heard, we can't do this work. I mean, I'm all for getting more counselors, but we're still not going to get there it with just our counselors. I know when I was advising at Chemeketa, where I really got to know the student was when I was their teacher. That's where I got to see how they functioned, what they were passionate about, what they really wanted to do. I couldn't do it in the few minutes that I was advising them on courses. And so we need the teachers to be able to identify a student, their passion, and help them figure out what that looks like in terms of a career. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you.
I want to thank everybody for your participation today. I think you've accomplished exactly what I was hoping to hear. Ms. Rivera, especially to you, showing what a passionate counselor looks like in real life. And appreciate your passion and all you do for kids. But the other thing that I was hoping that people would hear, and I think we did, was it really is a team sport. We have to get the administrators, we have to get the other teachers, because you can't do it as one counselor. So that part of building this community of support for the students to help them with their career decisions, helping them work that into the lesson so that it's relevant for them, and help them along the way. Just, you know, 5 minutes a year with a counselor just isn't going to quite cut it. So glad you're addressing all of that. Glad you shared that with us. I do have one quick question. You guys have talked about pathways today. Are you working with the community colleges and aligning the pathway work that they're doing?
Chair Rudin, I'm going to take that one on. I also serve on the CTE team, where we talk about CTE programs of study, and that's absolutely one of the areas that my team focuses on, is building those seamless transitions from high school into post-secondary, whatever that looks like, and helping students to know what they can take with them and what skills they need at the secondary level in order to meet the next steps needed in order to pursue that career pathway.
Are you connected with Greg Hammond at Lynn Benton?
Not currently. I'm sure someone on my team is.
That'd be a great tip.
I am.
And we have wonderful presentations from our community college folks. I'm looking at Andrea. She's kind of sitting in the back. But they really have done some phenomenal work. Greg has been in here a couple of times and talked to us about their pathways and the tools, the programs they've developed online, so they can do a better job of advising their students. And I think somehow there has to be a good connection across the board. And the community colleges are still developing that as well. But I think Greg was one of the superstars in that arena, so might be good to buy him a cup of coffee or something. So
thank you, Chair Reardon. Yeah. I have a buddy here who seems to know him, and I think we're going to make
well,
sure.
Well, I also want to say that I spent my morning at Jefferson High School with their advisor talking about apprenticeships and two-year pathways.
Great. Great. You get around.
Yeah.
Rep Solomon.
Thank you, Chair Reardon. Ms. Clark?
Yes.
Thank you so much for your information, and that externship sounds completely amazing. And I wonder if you have connected with your local STEM hub. I went to a STEM ecosystem conference, and where in Lancaster County, they have this externship with their high steel, high concrete. They get in a thing about concrete and cement. But they had something like this, and that just sounds like, I'm just curious if you've connected with them.
Yes, we have connected, and actually they just got a grant in which they funded 5 positions for this next year of the teacher externship, so we're excited about that.
Excellent. Great. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks again. This
Thank
has
you.
Been tremendous. So I am closing this informational hearing, and I'm going to try something unusual. So. All right.
You don't want to shake my hand. Thank you.
We're going to go into recess for about 3.5 minutes. Just so we can stand up and shift gears.
Thank you so much.
Just stand up. Shift gears a little bit. We have some other presentations.
Seven-year-old.
Different reason.
Anyway. Okay.
It helps. Can you plug me in? I'm supposed to. He'll plant arm and help get it through the house. Here, I'll plug you in right here.
So I'm opening an informational hearing on the role of community colleges in Oregon. And we'll be hearing a series of presentations. And Andrea, good to see you again. I just spent 3 days down at the coast with the Oregon Community College Association. Had a fantastic series of meetings down there and some dinner, and got to know the folks a little bit better.
Sounds really fun.
Yeah.
It's
curious.
Well, we may. You just never know. We might just hold our next hearing down there. Yeah,
there might allow someone besides the chair to go next time. All right, Mr. Dick.
Actually, my wife invited me to go. All right.
If you would stay for just you to go, then yeah.
We'll try to get them serious here. All right. Welcome to our meeting. We do appreciate your coming in to kind of give us an overview of what's going on. no real preconceptions on this.
Well, thank you, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And what I thought I would do today is talk about the mission of community colleges, what it is that we do, a little bit about our students, and a little bit about the funding of community colleges. So trying to get a comprehensive picture, essentially, of who we are and what we do. So with that, let me get started. So first, community colleges are an open access institutions. They're designed for anybody that needs an educational experience in their communities are open to go to the community colleges. And that's really one of the core foundations of the colleges, is that it's our colleges joke that community is in their middle name. It's really designed to meet those educational needs of all their population. So we've got community colleges around the state. Each of the colleges were created locally. So if you look at the map, there's white spaces where we don't have a community college. They don't necessarily follow the county lines because each of these community colleges were created because that local community came together and said, we want to have a community college. We're going to tax ourselves to have a community college, and organized around that. There is a process at the state level where the state approves the creation of the community colleges, but it is all locally driven. The areas in the white where we do not have a community college district, generally speaking, the population density isn't there for a college, but those communities are welcome if they wanted to at any time to create a community college. Our colleges came on board at various times, from 1961 to our newest community college in 1996. And again, this really shows the different time period in which communities decided to come together and form that community college. We also have had annexations along the way. In 1996, we also had the annexation of Curry County into Southwestern Oregon Community College, and the annexation of Jackson County into the Rogue Community College. And I also always need to mention that when I put this slide up, we have four different colleges that claim to be the first community college. I picked one of them to go first. I'm always hesitant to talk about that, and I look to see who's in the room before I talk about it. So a little bit about the governance of community colleges. And I wanted to kind of, it's a messy slide, but I wanted to get the sense that for each community college, there's a variety of different authorities and regulations that govern them. So certainly there's the state legislature and the legislation that you pass. We also have administrative rules through the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. We have the federal regulations, particularly around financial aid. And we have a regional accreditation that colleges do an extensive amount of work around their accreditation. And last and probably most importantly, we have the locally elected community college boards that have three main roles as elected board. They hire and fire the president, they set policy, and they protect the fiduciary interest of the community college. And so the hopefully, in the best possible world, all five of those line up. Sometimes they don't, and the colleges kind of shift through what is the responsibilities. So if you look at the mission of our community colleges, we have a broad, comprehensive mission. Oregon is different than other states in that we have the broadest community college mission. Not all states look like our community colleges. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about each element of this mission. With community colleges, while a large part of what we do is that lower division transfer for students that want to start at the community college and then transfer to the university, that's only one part of our mission. Secondly, we have our career technical education. So as you heard earlier about students exiting K through 12, do they follow a more career technical path or a four-year college path? The place where they most often come is to us. And we have both certificate and two-year degrees in career technical education and have a fairly robust career pathway model where students can come in, get a certificate, and leave and go into the workforce and then come back in, and that certificate is stackable up to a degree. Our career technical programs are very wide and varied. Some of our colleges have very specific niche programs. We have a aquarium science program over on the Oregon Coast Community College. We have a wind technician program in the Columbia Gorge. We have what's called MERTS on Clatsop Community College, which specifically trains those that are in the Coast Guard and shipping on essentially how to operate on a ship. So we have a variety of very specific programs. We do a lot in the healthcare industry, everything from pharmacy techs to phlebotomists to nursing, and many other areas that are fairly high-paying jobs to benefit both the students and the communities in which they serve. We also have what's called post-secondary remedial. So that's for all the students that are coming out of high school. They have their high school degree, but they're not yet at college-level work. And so we look at that as the post-secondary remedial. Now, we're making a lot of changes in that at the community colleges right now. There's a lot of national data and some Oregon data that shows that students that come out of high school test into remedial have a much lower chance of actually leaving with a certificate or degree. And so we've done a tremendous amount of work to really redo that system. One, we are moving away from high-stakes tests that are given to students and look more at students' GPA and classes they took to place them in the appropriate level. And secondly, we're increasingly, even when students test into remedial education, we're placing them into the college-level course with supports around that course to help them succeed. But that is still a large part of our mission, particularly for returning adults that perhaps haven't looked at a math textbook in 20 years, that there is some work that they need to do to get themselves ready for that college-level math class. The next piece I want to talk about is our adult basic education. And so the conversation you had earlier about what happens when those students aren't reading at third grade level, they hit middle school and they're not succeeding academically, those students come to us as adults. And a large part of about 7% of what we do is serving that adult population that's below a high school level. That's everything from helping them get ready to take their GED, but it's also adult basic skills. So it's for those students that need basic reading and writing so that they can get any job, and we serve those adults. And we also serve a great deal of English language learners. For those students that want to come in, we serve those students as well. And ideally with all of these, there's a pathway that's created. Not enough students follow the pathway, but, you know, in a perfect world, a student could come in, learn their adult basic skills, get to the place where they can take a GED, move from that into a career technical or into a lower division transfer program. So it's a very, very wide variety of needs that we serve with the adult basic education. We also talk a lot about the adult continuing education, and that's part of our mission as well. So as you think about students that adults in the community that want to come in and take a class, maybe it's conversational French or it's learning how to paint. These are non-credit classes that serve that at the needs of the community. We don't get state support for those classes. They're self-supporting, but is a large part of what the community colleges provide in their local environment. We also have workforce-related classes as part of the continuing education as well. Many of our colleges operate small business development centers where they offer classes and support for local community members that would like to start a small business. And then we also do quite a few contracts with businesses as part of our business and training so that our community colleges can work with a local business, design a curriculum for them, deliver the curriculum to skill up their employees. That's our comprehensive mission. It's fairly extensive in terms of what the community colleges do. And this shows essentially by FTE area what percentage of our mission is in each of these areas. So as I mentioned, the highest amount, 55% approximately, is in that lower division transfer. Approximately 26% is in our career technical. And then I wanted to highlight both 7% in our adult basic skills and our adult continuing education. So it gives you a sense of within that comprehensive mission, where we're spending our time. Now, this slide is by FTE, full-time equivalent. And that's a measure that's designated by how many contact hours the colleges have with a student. It's not a headcount, and the headcount number is very different. And so I want to show you the same information by headcount. And the interesting piece that you will see is 32% of our students by headcount are in those adult continuing education classes. So again, that's that painting or conversational French, et cetera. So that's a large part of the headcount, but not necessarily in terms of the FTE.
Is FTE like 12 credits or is that?
So Chair Reardon, it's not directly aligned to credits.
Okay.
It's 510 contact hours. And so it's how much contact that particular student has with the college. It was designed that way so that our career technical programs that have more contact with the students have a slight advantage in the FTE for reimbursements.
As they should.
So, and this slide shows, again, the various different areas that we offer as part of our comprehensive mission, and it shows over time what percentage of our mission has been. I like this slide because it shows the upper area in green is our lower division transfer. Our next biggest chunk is in the career technical. And what you see in about 2009 is the gap widening. And this is very specifically as we were going through budget cuts. Colleges eliminated career technical programs. They're more expensive to offer. Lower division transfer is much easier to generate money from it. And as they were making cuts, they cut career technical programs. And so you can see the percentage of what we do increased in the lower division transfer and decreased in career technical. And I think from a policy perspective, as we think about reinvestments in community colleges, at the top of the list really are their career technical programs, which are very expensive to do, but critical for our communities and for our students. This is how many students we have each year in the community college system. And I just wanted to point that out, that number. It's a large number of Oregonians. And this is just on a yearly basis. So many, many people come in, they take a class, they take two classes, they get a certificate, they leave, but they also come back. And so over the years, we really do impact the lives of many, many Oregonians. So let me talk a little bit about who our students are. So our students, the majority of our students, almost two-thirds of them, are 25 or older. So as you think about college students, the picture is of somebody coming right out of high school and moving on to college. But that's not necessarily our community college students. You know, we do have a group that are in that range. About 30% of them are in that kind of traditional community college range. But the bulk of our students are older adults that are coming back into the community college. Most of them, a majority of them are female. And let me move on to the next slide that has some more data about them. Another thing that's interesting about community colleges and different than the four-year universities is the majority of our students are part-time students. Many of them, most of them are working. Some are working full-time. And 30% of them have children. So it's a very different demographic, and it's really about that adult learner that's coming back into the community college, which really means that the supports that we need to have in place for our students are very different types of supports, because not only are they adult learners that are coming back, but if they are working, they may not have as many opportunities to work full-time, to earn a living, and so it's that opportunity loss for them as well in order to afford to go to the community college. So last year, there was a national study done on food and housing insecurity in community colleges. So I see some heads nodding. You've seen some of this data. It's very startling, and has really changed our conversation around our students and what supports that they need to have. Essentially, 47% of students that were across the nation of community college students that were surveyed, 47% of them had some sort of food insecurity in the last month. And these numbers really aren't different if you're comparing urban, rural community colleges, large or small. The numbers tend to be fairly similar. And I think particularly of that, 37% of our students ate less in the last month because of lack of food. The study also looked at housing insecurity. And this really looks at Almost 50% of our students had some sort of housing insecurity in the last year. And this slide really talks about the different ways that that manifested itself, whether they couldn't pay their rent or they couldn't pay their utilities or they had to move in with other people. But almost 50% of them had some sort of housing insecurity in the last year. And more startling, approximately 14% of them were homeless in the last year. And this slide really shows the different ways in which they were homeless, whether they had to sleep in a place that wasn't a home or they were in a shelter, whatever it might be. And this has really changed our conversation as we think about students and as we think about affordability for our community college students. It's not just about the tuition number. It's about the entire needs of that community college student, whether it's their housing or it's their food, it's childcare, it's transportation. One of the things that really is clear is that students that are at the community college, one thing that happens during a term can really impact their ability to finish school. And as we think about as they try to make their lives better, they try to get that certificate, they try to get their transfer degree, many times the system's working against them. And as we think about how we might do that better, a couple of clear ideas have come forward. One, we're working to look at how all the benefits available to Oregonians might be better coordinated to serve college students. And that's really a key piece for us to think about SNAP and TANF and other benefits that might be available and how can we really leverage those to benefit our students. The other piece that colleges are examining is what's known as short-term grants. And so if a student comes in and they have a flat tire or they need a bus pass, whatever might have happened, having that ability to access short-term grants, not loans, but grants so that they can come in the door, and whatever that barrier is for them to continuing, that's available to them. And having that in place, research shows, really increases our retention because it really helps students kind of bridge that gap.
May I have a little comment?
Yes, rip one.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. That the grant proposal that you were just talking about, I got a message from our my college, and they were talking about last mile scholarships, and it was to help kids who were just about to finish but were just short on tuition or whatever it was, and that was being shown to increase graduation rates. Because you're right, that one little bump can set them off. But even when they're, 95% there, trying to get them over the hump with that last little, I don't know, it could be $500, it could be $100, is something that I think is also important, too. So,
yeah. Is that something that foundations are possibly talking about providing in some kind of a grant fund for that? It seems like a relatively small, I would hope a relatively small amount.
So, Chair Reardon, I think colleges are looking at a variety of ways of how to fund that. Certainly going to foundations is part of it, but that emergency grant piece is really key. There's also some states that have implemented what's called a free-to-finish program. And so particularly for students that have dropped out, if they're within a term or two of graduating, how do we get them back in the door so that tuition is waived for them so they can complete? I know Washington's been looking at that as a proposal. If there's any legislators that wanted to look at funding that, we would love to have that conversation. So let me move to talking a little bit about tuition and fees. As you can see from this, from 2003 to 2004 to this last year, our tuition has increased dramatically for our community college students. And to kind of put it in perspective, looking at the other Western states, we're up 5% from last year. We're up 18% in the last 5 years, and we're up 65% in the last decade. Yeah. And that's really impacted our students. So keeping in mind that affordability isn't just tuition, tuition is making it far more difficult for our students. So as we look at the investments in community colleges, and this is a quote that really talks about in community colleges, we serve the most difficult to serve community colleges, and we receive the least money to do it. And so I think you'll see the people in community colleges, it's really a labor of love to try to help those students and kind of move them through. So looking at the state investment in community colleges, so this chart really shows that over, essentially since 2005, the share of the state general fund for community colleges is dropping. So in 2003-05 biennium, it was approximately 4% of the state general fund. In the most current biennium, that had dropped down to 2.88% of the general fund. And so the investment that the state's making is kind of moving down for those community colleges. Our community colleges are funded by three key areas. It's the state investment, it's tuition, and it's local property taxes. And what this chart shows, which I think is very interesting, is that it starts in 1989-90, which was pre-Measure 5. And pre-Measure 5, approximately 50% of the cost for community college came from local property taxes. About 20% came from students, about 30% came from the state general fund. As Measure 5 was implemented, it shifted. Because there was that property tax limitation put in place, essentially property taxes and the state investments switched so that 50% was coming from the state and 20% continued to come from the students. What we've seen over the last 10 years is it shifting again. And so you can really see in that 2009 biennium that the same place where we lost a lot of our career technical programs, we shifted so that tuition is now the highest percentage of what funds community colleges. It's close to 50% now coming from the students. And that's a significant shift over the years.
Sure.
So I'm going to skip that one and go on to some of the other details. So this really shows what the expenditures are by category. So as you think about what is it that we do for our students, this is how the colleges spend the money. Where approximately 58% of it goes to either direct instruction or instructional support. And another 20% goes into the support for the colleges, that's essentially the administration, as well as 12% that goes into student services. This is another area where the colleges have cut their investments is around student support. We know that student support is what helps students succeed, the funding for community colleges is based on reimbursable FTE. So the more students you get in the door, the more money you get from the state. Investing in advisors and other student supports is not where the colleges get funded for the state. So there's kind of a disincentive there into getting students in the door, but not necessarily helping them get out the door. We are changing that in the community colleges. Chair Worden mentioned earlier the work of Lynn Benton Community College under the presidency of Greg Heyman, and they really are moving forward on implementing the guided pathways, which has both a clear pathway for students, but also that advising support around it. This fall is the first kind of foray into guided pathways, and one of the things that's happened that they're very surprised about is they're not seeing the drop-off rates. So students that register, generally speaking, you'll see a drop-off of students that register, come to class, and then drop out. And they're not seeing that at Lynn Benton this fall. It's too soon to know why, but certainly the speculation is as you're advising students up front, as you're putting them on a pathway and they know what to take, students are staying in class and they're not dropping out. So that's going to be really interesting to see as we go forward if that indeed is true and as other colleges move towards guided pathways, what kind of results that we're seeing.
Yeah. Andrea, just FYI, on the time management part, we're going to be able to go till about 5 after.
Okay. So. All right. So this is really looking at our degree and certificate completion. So at the same time we've been having cuts from the state, we've really increased the number of degrees and certificates that our colleges are awarding. So essentially about 2007, we've gone up from 6,700 degrees to 12,000. And our certificates have an even greater increase from 1,700 to 9,300. I believe I've shared this slide before, but what's really interesting about this is you break it out by race and ethnicity. Particularly our Latino students and our African-American students have a higher percentage increase in degree and certificate completion. We don't know exactly why yet. We're doing something right. We would really like to know what that is so we can increase our numbers even more. But this looks at the certificate completion, very similar for degree completions. The multiracial, I think, is a difference in reporting, so we're kind of dismissing that. But again, it's showing a by race and ethnicity increases. So I am going to, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip through a couple of slides and talk a little bit about, in greater detail, about CTE programs. As I mentioned before, our CTE programs are really expensive. And so, for example, nursing can cost as much as $28,000. These are good-paying jobs. We have very large waiting lists at each of our colleges to get into the nursing programs. And it's difficult to offer as many slots as possible because of that cost. So one of the things that we've been looking at is taking a look at our CTE programs and really understanding the return on investment for local communities. And so Rogue Community College really started this by taking a look at some of our key CTE programs and matching that data with the employment department and understanding what the increase salaries were, essentially, for those various programs. So they took five of their CTE programs and matched that up. And it just basically in 1 year, $3.7 million in new state wages from that program. So we then took that work and expanded it out to all 17 colleges. Now, this isn't all of the CTE programs. Each college picked five programs and, again, matched the wage data and really saw that the average wage coming out of those programs was $24 an hour, and it created $47 million in new tax dollars. So we think that's pretty significant. So as we think about what we do with our CTE programs and how valuable they are, it's not just for the students and for the communities, but it's also a benefit to the state.
Is that total wages paid or taxes paid?
Mm-hmm. So that's, that's total wages paid.
Okay.
And I'm going to stop there so I have time to answer any questions that you might
have. Sorry, we don't have more time. We're just going to go through briskly today. But
yes.
Questions? Rep. Solman.
Thank you, Chair Reardon. I appreciate you mentioning the guided pathways because that was something that I had written down. When you talk about, when you're looking at dropout rates, meaning students not completing their time in community college, a lot of times from what I was explaining is, when you come into community college, you might take this course. This is what my pathway was. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, so I took this one, and then I took this one. I didn't come out with a degree. I didn't come out with a certification at all. So I appreciate that guided pathways look. I appreciate the conversation around looking at what CTE programs, because that's a guided pathway in itself as well. And I'm just wondering if you could touch a little bit about how you feel CTE funding and Measure 98 with how that could benefit for the work there from K-12 to benefit community college. Curious if you see anything there. And then also, when you look at the graduation rates for Future Connect students, usually it's 30-some percent, but with Future Connect, it's something like 71%. If you wanted to maybe just touch a little bit.
All right. Chair Reed and Representative Solman. First of all, with the Future Connect, it has absolutely tremendous results. And that's really around designing the support services that benefit the students. We did receive $3 million in this last legislative session for replication grants for other colleges to create Future Connect-like programs, which is exciting.
Wonderful.
On the guided pathways work, Lynn Benton has kind of led the work on that. But we actually, right now, colleges are doing the application process, and we expect to have 4 to 6 colleges start in the spring with a 2-year curriculum around implementing guided pathways. So we're moving quickly to have the other colleges move into that. And on the Measure 98, that's certainly, while that's K-12 funding, it's really about designing those partnerships and those pathways for students from K-12 into the community college.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. really sorry we don't have more time. I spent 3 days with Community College Association, and every minute was interesting. So a half hour doesn't do justice, but we got a few good points here. And thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm closing this informational hearing. And by the way, if you have forgotten my invitation / challenge to visit schools, some of the schools between now and the January session, I did that. I drove all the way to Treasure Valley, and it was totally worthwhile to do that. You don't have to go that far, but someplace away from your home. Go visit another place. And by the way, your office funding can be used for that purpose. It was a struggle to find that much out, but we were able to get reimbursed for that. So so it was really totally worthwhile to go see firsthand, in this case, a different part of the state, meet some different people and see what their programs, their challenges are. But so would really encourage you to do that if at all possible.
Okay. So if Rep. Clem goes to University of Oregon on a Saturday to investigate their sports program, would that?
I don't think that was it. I think he probably wants to go to Klamath Falls.
Okay, there you go.
I'm sure he does.
I don't think he'd go to U of O.
He goes to U of O.
And it would not be to U of O to watch a ball game unless the Beavers were crushing him that day. Thank you.
And we know that's highly unlikely. So.
Little afternoon fun.
Okay. Anyway, here we go. I'm opening an informational hearing on the role of public universities in Oregon. So we have Dana, Tim, and Chris.
I have to talk to Tim, but not for 20 minutes. Yeah. Let me keep thinking about which way to go there. Cut off.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's nice to be here. For the record, my name is Dana Richardson. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Presidents, a voluntary association of the public university presidents in Oregon. We are here today to talk to you that's really totally different than what you just heard from the community colleges. We love talking about our students. That's usually what we're doing when we talk with you here, but that's not what we're going to focus on today. We're going to focus on some programs run out of the public universities that you may not be familiar with, programs that focus on economic development, economic impacts in the state, research and commercialization in business and workforce development, as well as a variety of programs that impact each community within our 36 counties in Oregon. So I think the message we're trying to get across here is, put simply, the return the state of Oregon sees on its investment in public universities far outweighs its actual investment. So I've got three folks with me here, and I have to read their titles because they're all very prestigious folks. So from each of our panelists, you'll hear from Tim Dewey. He's a professor of practice, co-director of undergraduate studies, director of Oregon's Economic Forum, and he works at the University of Oregon. Jennifer Dill, who is the interim vice president of research and a professor at the School of Urban Studies and Planning from Portland State. And Chris Jennings, the digital marketing manager and festival director at the Eastern Oregon Film Festival at Eastern Oregon University. So these are really broad topics.
Beavers.
We could spend an hour on each, but we won't.
The Beavers.
We're going to try and walk you through some of this information in the next 30 minutes or so. But because there's a lot of information that underlies what you'll get a sense of today, we've provided additional information, a supplemental packet. I think it's nearly 90 pages in length. there are a lot of programs, and we don't have a chance to highlight all of them, but we're happy to be here to focus on a few. And I will hand it over to Tim.
Great. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Tim Dewey from the University of Oregon. I appreciate everybody's time this afternoon. So I'm going to talk a little bit about economic impact for Oregon's higher education system, particularly the public universities. So, you know, one of the features of the university system is that we develop basically a prepared workforce for the 21st century. And one place where I think this became really evident in recent months when Amazon was looking for a location for their second headquarters, and they specified in their request for bids that a highly educated labor pool is critical and a strong university system is required. And that seems like a fairly clear indication of what successful firms of the 21st century are going to be looking for when they relocate or develop their business opportunities. So I think that's a clear indication. Beyond that, beyond the preparing the workforce, which I know that we are already known for, there's a host of ways by which the universities influence and impact the state's economy. First, we conduct research, federal, industry, private grants, partnerships with Oregon business initiatives, research centers across the state, and we really add to the stock of knowledge within the community, and that becomes partially a public good that everybody in the community gets to basically enrich their lives, enrich their businesses with. We increase employment in the communities in which we're located. We do that either directly through our hiring, through new businesses that become offshoots of the activities we do. We increase employment through the multiplier effect, through the improvement in the local economies brought about by the university system. We build quite a bit of infrastructure throughout the state, and that infrastructure really ranges across the board. There's capital projects throughout the state, and a lot of times these capital projects are leveraging private donor money. So the state is getting a little bit of extra bang for its buck in utilizing these private donor funds. We have lots of programs that are contributing to communities and social well-being. So, for example, University of Oregon is currently under working with a plan to embed faculty members from the College of Education in Oregon high schools. Eastern Oregon University operates Eastern Oregon Head Start, and that would probably could take all day to list all of the kinds of activities that are currently underway. Also, we have basically creating business opportunities, supporting new companies. Many of our universities are either directly or indirectly running programs in which students engage with the business community in many ways. And then attracting talent from around the world. World-class universities attract students and faculty from across the country and across the globe. And those highly skilled individuals contribute, often stay in Oregon, and often contribute great deals of benefits for the Oregon economy. So that's a fairly high-level overview, and again, because we do have limited time, I do want to take a little bit of that time and think about some of the specific economic impacts that we're seeing by campus. And so, for example, Portland State University estimates their economic impact in the state is $1.44 billion. They're also awarded the best accelerator, best university accelerator, business accelerator in the U.S. in 2015. Eastern Oregon University has 300 locally employed residents and over $110 million spent locally in that community, for an example. Southern Oregon University has a large proportion of their graduates employed in Oregon within rural Jackson and Josephine counties, and spend almost $100 million in Jackson and Josephine counties, contribute $200 million to economic activity to the region. And that's in addition to over almost 1,800 jobs. The University of Oregon and Oregon State University each contribute over $2 billion to the state's economy, and combined will add over 50,000 jobs to the state's economy. So these are extremely large institutions and making very large economic contributions to the community. The list goes on and on. Western Oregon University. Over 1,500 employees. Since 2010, $80 million in capital construction in that community. Produced 211 licensed teachers.
Boom.
I'm sorry?
Oh, I just said boom. Sorry.
We get excited up here about your...
Okay. I'm excited about it, too. Oregon Tech, 700 jobs in Klamath County, $75 million annually, another 300 jobs in Portland, high employment rates. These are students that are in high demand from our local employers. And then OHSU, a massive institution, 16,000 people employed directly, 34,000 jobs supported, billions of dollars of economic impact, innovations, patents, almost a million patient visits. It's really an amazing amount of work done by the Oregon universities, and all of this is very meaningful and impactful for our communities and from an economic perspective. And I'll close it up there because we've got lots of presentations.
Just on who owns the patents? There's 30 U.S. and foreign patents. Does OHSU hold those, or is that?
No, you're out of my depth on that one. That's the patents they claim, but they either are going to be either owned by them or owned by their faculty, I'd imagine. But you'd have to contact them directly.
We can follow.
There you go. All right.
All right. Quick, many of those I know at Portland State University.
Need to have you introduce yourself.
I was answering the question first. I shouldn't have done that. My name is Jennifer Dill. I'm a professor of urban studies and planning, and I'm currently the interim vice president of research at Portland State University. Thank you very much for spending some time with us. On that, I know at Portland State, those patents that come from university research are often either solely held by the university or jointly held between the university and maybe a spin-out company, but it depends on the actual patent. But yeah, it generates significant revenue for our universities.
That's where I would.
So. All right. So I'm going to talk a bit about sort of the impact of research and scholarship from our universities. And as this slide shows, there's a wide range of impact. What we've touched on just now is some of that industry innovation and economic growth through spin-out companies, new products, new discoveries that are going into the market. But there's a wide range of benefits beyond that, including informed public policy decisions, improving health and safety and quality of life, and workforce education and training. And in the examples I'll give a little bit later from three of our campuses, it will highlight all four of those. Before I jump into that, I do want to clarify a few things in terms of rankings and classifications, because I know there's often talk about being a research university, and I just want to clarify sort of what we mean when we use that term research university, because it does have a specific meaning in some contexts. And in particular, the Carnegie system classifies about 4,000 accredited institutions of higher education throughout the country, ranging from community colleges to four-year degree program universities to universities that grant doctoral degrees, such as Portland State, University of Oregon, and Oregon State, in addition to special focus universities like OHSU. So there's a full range there. And among the doctoral granting institutions, the Carnegie system ranks the institution based on several metrics in terms of research productivity, doctorates granted, and other indicators. And so there's three classifications for doctoral granting institutions. University of Oregon and Oregon State are ranked as R1, meaning highest research universities. There are 115 universities throughout the country in that category. Portland State is ranked as an R2, higher research university, and there's 107 universities in those categories, in that category throughout the U.S. And what that means from the perspective of those three universities in particular is that we're competing with about 200 other universities for top faculty to teach and do research on our campuses. We're also competing with those universities for attracting students and graduate students, undergrad and graduate, who are interested in a university that's engaged in research of all types. So talking a bit about some of the metrics, I always have to be careful because there's a lot of work that we do at the university that is research and scholarship that can't really be quantified when you think about the wide range of disciplines on all of our campuses. But of course, we try to quantify a lot, and some numbers that we put up here. This is for the four research universities, OHSU, U of O, Oregon State, and PSU combined have about nearly $800 million in externally funded research going on. With that, and related to that, there are now 122 spin-out companies that started from those Oregon universities that still have a presence in Oregon that are generating jobs and new technologies and new products. Speaking of new products, those companies have produced or taken 875 products to market, a wide range of products that we'll touch on a few of them in a moment. In fact, actually, right now. So this slide, I certainly don't expect you to read all of those logos. What we wanted to do is give you a sense of all of the different companies that have spun out from the Oregon universities. This isn't quite all of them, but it is a lot of them, and some of them you may recognize. I'm going to highlight just a couple. One of them from Portland State University, which is APDM. It started with a PSU professor who was searching for a wearable movement sensor capable of collecting data from people with Parkinson's disease. It has since grown into a company that provides a wide range of solutions for quantifying human movement with wearable technologies and employs about 20 people in the Portland area. Let's see. Design Medics is another company from PSU that's working on a malaria drug. And Defunkify, which I believe you have a sample of in your packets. It's a little blue. There it is. Exactly. That is a spin-out from University of Oregon faculty who created this revolutionary fabric cleaning and deodorizing product that is specifically helps get all those Oregonians and beyond their outdoor clothing and athletic clothing defunkified, smelling a lot nicer.
Somehow I knew this was inspired by athletic wear.
I have a son that played lacrosse. I would have used this.
There you go. So that's being sold in that's being sold in stores throughout Oregon and beyond.
Wash the funk out is what it says.
Careful.
Still get your funk on in other ways. So I'm just going to quickly run through some highlights from three campuses, starting with Portland State. It's always difficult when you're put in this position to pick one example from the campus to share because the wide range of work that we do. I did take the liberty here of choosing one from our transportation program, which I've been involved in the 17 years that I've been at Portland State, and that's the Transportation Research and Education Center. We engage in a wide range of research, a lot of which is having an impact in Oregon and beyond. For example, our transit research is helping agencies run more efficiently. In particular, TriMet has used the results of our research to better schedule their operators, saving them about $1 million a year in operating. We are always working with ODOT. We have bridge experts who are working with ODOT on new technologies that will reinforce bridges, perhaps more effectively when the next earthquake comes, and hopefully also at a lower cost. We are working on, you may have heard about some of the research we did recently about racial disparities amongst people in crosswalks and racial disparities in terms of drivers yielding to people in crosswalks. So we do a lot of work on improving safety of pedestrians, bicycles, bicyclists, drivers, and other people using our transportation system. We also do a lot related to workforce. All of the research projects that we are engaged in involve students, undergraduate and graduate students. We are also reaching out in terms of attracting younger people to the workforce. We had a 2-week summer camp this past summer with high school girls, so introducing them to transportation as a potential career, particularly connected to STEM education and other topics. We also, I want to note, as part of the center, we have a federal, we are one of the 5 national university transportation centers, and with that we have 5 university partners, including Oregon Tech and University of Oregon, in addition to some partners outside of the state. And that we have been funded for over $29 million in federal funding over the years for that center. From Oregon State University, and I'm going to have to follow my notes a little bit more since this isn't my direct work, a couple things that we want to highlight here are the Pacific Marine Energy Center. OSU is poised to provide the infrastructure needed to accelerate the growth of emerging wave energy industry through the construction of its Pacific Marine Energy Center South Energy Test Site. It's located off the coast of Newport, and it will be the first full-scale grid-connected wave energy test site in the United States to support the development, testing, and commercialization of wave energy conversion technology. OSU received a $35 million grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to design and construct this facility. And they have numerous partners, both public and private, throughout the state that they'll be working with in development and using this facility. I also want to highlight something that you may have heard about. I know I did in the news about a year or so ago, and that's an OSU chemistry professor, his discovery of a brilliant new blue pigment called yinmin. It was actually discovered several years ago, but in 2016, there was a video created about it that got a lot of attention, including 12 million online shares and a lot of media attention. Perhaps more, in some ways more important, last year, Yinmin Blue was licensed for commercial use and received EPA approval. Part of those patent revenues, here's an example, part of those patent revenues go back to OSU's research program. And then you may have also that Crayola is now using that in one of their new crayon colors.
And I have to give you the 5-minute warning for this whole group.
Okay. In that case, I will. This is my last, which is University of Oregon, and they are participating in a large NIH-funded program, the Environmental Influences of Child Health Outcomes. This is a program led by NIH with $157 million in awards nationally. Of that, U of O is getting $19 million to focus on research on early growth and development study, focusing on 1,000 children living in biological and adoptive homes. And with this is a long-term study that we expect to have significant impacts on child health outcomes, both here in Oregon and nationally.
My name is Christopher Jennings. I'm the digital marketing manager at Eastern Oregon University, and I'm also the festival director of Eastern Oregon Film Festival. And I'm here to kind of talk to you about the community engagement aspect and how our universities as a whole engage in a broad variety of activities at the community level, and how that enforces and creates
and
pipelines.
Thank you for making the trip over here. I just made that drive a couple weeks ago, and
it's a good one. Isn't
glad
it?
To have you here.
So I got 3 minutes to make that worth it, right?
All right.
So we'll stay afterwards.
Oh, I appreciate it. The university as a whole bring together, skills and expertise and all the different things that we need to get into our students early on, and the students themselves get to spill that back into the communities. And the universities help foster that, nurture that engagement. I'm going to skip through some real quick slides here that represent the expanse of what we do. So the universities as a whole, this map indicates that there's activity in all 36 of our counties in Oregon, and the universities drive that. So when you think of the university main campuses, that's just a small piece of the impact that resonates throughout the state. So this illustrates centers and various secondary offices of the university system throughout. One of the main things that we do is we work to solve problems. So using students, using faculty, using thinking, we work with our communities, we identify problems, we help create and nurture a culture of problem solvers. And by doing so, we get to engage in new projects and different opportunities all the time. Some of those examples are, U of O and the Community Service Center, OIT's Population Health Management Program, Western's Research Institute, OHSU, which, just goes above and beyond in all realms. We also work to increase the college-going pipeline. So you're always working to interact with the youth earlier, because we find that if you can engage with children at younger parts of their educational career, that they're more likely to get invested in higher ed, to become that mountaineer, to become that duck or whatever. You build and foster and nurture our pipeline. And all the universities have individual programs and services that are really geared towards nurturing and cultivating them. One in particular, SOU's Academia Latina, provides leadership and college prep programming for Latino students starting in seventh grade. Over the past 10 years, participating students had an average high school graduation rate of 89%. 78% of the students go on to enroll in college, and that's compared to 39% of overall other students. So that's a good example of how that works. I'm going to just jump right ahead because arts education is what I'm most passionate about, and I think every university has arts and culture built into their threads, and they like to spill that out where they can. SOU has a massive amount of theater productions and arts, and I, however, have come to terms with loving film and stuff since the beginning. As a EOU student, I was engaged in multimedia earlier in theater, and after that, I began figuring out how to bring that to Eastern Oregon. Being in a rural community, access to arts and education and that kind of combination of stuff is limited, and it's hard to bring in talent. So part of my goal and other people's goal that I worked with over the years is let's bring that talent to Eastern Oregon, let's get our students engaging with those industry professionals and create opportunities. Founded in 2009, since then we've hosted combining filmmakers and musicians, almost 300 individual artists that have come into our valley. We've screened over 100 independent feature films, most of which are out in distribution now, and we've seen them even sometimes before Sundance saw them. We've had secret screenings, and we've engaged with networks of filmmakers that have really kind of fell in love with Eastern Oregon. We've created a really neat niche festival, voted top 25 coolest in the world last year by Movie Maker Magazine, and started just building something so unique to our region that just resonates well with our community, but is now reaching the industry and reaching this side of the state. OPB highlight us this year. We had a live recording of State of Wonder at our festival just half a month ago now, which opened a lot of people's ears and eyes to what we've been doing. So I'm really grateful for that opportunity. We and ourselves have had a huge impact on our community. We have a small community. We have a small county. We have small population. But over that 8 years, a rough estimate, a conservative estimate, is $1.25 million in economic benefit to our LeGrand and Union County spill out. And that doesn't account for some of the residual travel coming in. So those people spend money on the way as well. Again, one of the coolest festivals. This was this year's in particular event. 21 feature films, 35 shorts, 4 out-of-town music bands coming in, all coming in to hang out and talk and interact. And what's really unique about our festival, and I've heard this from both the filmmakers as well as the participants, is that unlike Sundance, where it's kind of a, here's all the filmmakers up here, and they're doing their big thing, and it's all for show, and the audience gets to go over here and maybe watch, you know, we really throw them all into one room, and we say, you know, interact and talk. Let's talk about your films. Let's get engaged. And the student interaction this year in particular has been phenomenal. We got to give internships. We got to give opportunities for practicum. But then they also got to sit and have a long conversation with this filmmaker that's on the rise and is showing at Sundance next, you know. So those opportunities really stick into a student's mind and can create resonate with them to create a reason to, one, stay. So retention is big, right? Let's create experiences that keep students here. And then gives them inspiration to go further and take the next step wherever they end up with. So I'm excited about the film festival, obviously. I invite all of you to come over next year.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited about the bridge it's creating with our university. I mean, that's one of the ties I want to really touch on is that, you know, we work with faculty to bring programming. We work with the university as a venue. We get fiscal support to help fund the projects. And without EOU and without that culture that exists in Eastern Oregon, the festival really wouldn't be there. I mean, I wouldn't have started at EOU and started a festival if it wasn't there. And I think without the university system there, it couldn't have sustained as long as it has. So with that, thank you very much. I don't know if you have...
We're happy to answer any questions.
Happy to answer any questions.
I'm hoping we don't have too many questions.
Sorry.
I feel bad. I have to give him the
I'm going
to
talk really fast.
Okay. Faster than me, I bet. Yeah.
Well, it can be done.
Real quick.
Thank you. I just wanted to say two things. I recently attended the Simon Benson dinner, and they were showing and featuring Dorothy Lemelson. Okay. And they were saying how she was really implementing programs and helping innovative, like, innovative ideas for these students to come up with their ideas and market them and research them. So that was really exciting to see that up on the screen. And I was curious when you talk, so it's two part. One is the research proceeds. How does that, I understand it's building the program, but does it benefit students directly in the form of like tuition scholarships? So is there scholarships that come back to students from that? And then when is the film festival? That's my second.
That's the important one.
Yeah.
On the direct benefits to students, so that $800 million in external funding. Many of those grants do include tuition waivers for the students who are, so when I hire a research student on my federal grant, mm-hmm. That federal grant is paying tuition in addition to a stipend for the time that they're doing the work. So it does support a lot of students.
Okay, thank you.
The next festival, the ninth annual, will be October, the third week in October next year. We kind of sit on the tails of Bend Film is usually 2 weeks prior to that. And October is kind of a big festival film month in Oregon. There's a lot of industry activity and a lot of events going on. So,
in Le Grand.
In Oregon in general, but our festival... No. Yeah,
your festival.
In Le Grand, yes, for the film festival.
Maybe we could get on your invite list or something.
Yeah, jump on the website, the Facebook page, all
I was
of
gonna
that.
Say there's got to be a Facebook
okay.
page.
Yeah, it'll.
All right.
Yeah.
Sorry to rush you guys. We could obviously we'd all love to chat with you for a couple more hours probably, but there are folks behind you and. It's running out of time, but thanks for making the trip over.
Yeah, thank you for your time.
Actually, anybody that drives from Portland, thank you as well. So.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Nice job. It's got passion, too.
Oh, I am closing this informational meeting, and I'm opening an informational hearing on the role of nonprofit colleges and universities in Oregon. So. We've done community colleges, public universities. Now we're up to nonprofits.
What happened to the for-profits? Chair?
Mm-hmm. I said that wrong, didn't I?
No, you didn't.
Oh. What?
Are you going to do the for-profits?
Where does it say nonprofits?
Yeah, it's correct.
Private nonprofit colleges and universities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No for-profits?
Not today. Okay. All right. Sorry for that. welcome, and you know, somebody has to go last.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Thomas Helley. I live in McMinnville, Oregon. I'm president of Linfield College, here today representing the 18 private nonprofit institutions of the Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities. Although our colleges are individually quite diverse, the Alliance is entirely comprised of regionally accredited nonprofit institutions of higher learning. Each is founded on and guided by a mission imbued with these important social principles, that education is the key to ending poverty, fostering economic and social mobility, and that education builds community, preparing adults for lives of meaningful work and citizenship. We thank you for the opportunity to talk about independent higher education in Oregon, our partnership in supporting the state's educational attainment goals, and our shared stake in the state's current and future economic and social well-being. We also thank you for your support of the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. As state policymakers, I'm sure you're hearing what public and private college and university presidents also hear from Oregon's business leaders. They urge us to graduate students who can compete in knowledge-based industries and global economies. Accordingly, our state educational attainment goals call for all Oregonians to be high school graduates, for 40% to hold associate's degrees or equivalent, and for another 40% to hold bachelor's or higher degrees by the year 2025. At present, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission reports that about 35% of Oregonians age 25 to 34 hold bachelor's or higher degrees, 5% short of the goal, 8 years away from the deadline. Now, the Alliance has been the state's longtime partner in this effort to increase the educational attainment of Oregon residents. In fact, currently, 1 in 5 undergraduate students at a four-year college or university in Oregon is enrolled at an Alliance member school. And collectively, our member schools confer 22% of the state's undergraduate degrees and nearly half of master's and doctoral degrees in the state of Oregon. The fastest growing occupational fields, STEM professions, including health professions, of course, demand higher levels of post-secondary education. Alliance member colleges and universities confer significant percentages of STEM degrees as well, specifically 20% of the state's core STEM bachelor's degrees, 24% of business management and marketing bachelor's degrees in the state of Oregon are from Alliance schools, 22% of economics and political science degrees, 34%, more than one-third of the math and statistics bachelor's degrees in the state come from Alliance schools, 38% of Bachelor of Education degrees, 35% of all health professions bachelor's degrees, including 60% of all nursing degrees, come from these private colleges. But that said, Oregon's private independent colleges and universities actually cost the state very little. Our schools receive no direct allocations from state coffers. Opportunity grants, which represent a small but very important fraction of the state's higher education resources, are allocated directly to Oregon students who can put those resources toward their expenses at any Oregon college or university, public or private. In 2016, 92% of the state's total Oregon opportunity grants went to students enrolled in public institutions, about 8% to students enrolled at the Alliance member institutions, or to about 2,500 students. Oregonians make up 72% of Linfield College's students. A quarter of those students rely on the Oregon Opportunity Grant to attend college. As those are our state's most economically disadvantaged students, that support is much appreciated, and we thank you. Alliance member schools seek to make opportunity grant dollars go as far as possible, and we leverage them with our own institutional aid by as much as 475% with our own institutional aid in support of students' educations. An August 2017 study conducted by the TIAA Research for the Council of Independent Colleges, a national organization, showed that a bachelor's degree from a public institution is 6.4 times more costly to state taxpayers than a bachelor's degree from a private institution. For example, if the undergraduates at Alliance member colleges were instead enrolled at state institutions, their undergraduate educations would cost taxpayers an estimated additional $166 million from start to finish. So, every time an Oregon student chooses a private nonprofit institution instead of a public one, it saves the state money because that student's education is primarily paid through private college tuition and donor dollars, as opposed to state tax revenue. Now, there are a lot of myths about private higher education, and I'd like to dispel one of the most common ones, that we serve predominantly white students from middle-class and upper-middle-class families. The 35,000 students on our campuses today in Oregon reflect a diversity of communities and experiences. One-third of our students hail from demographic groups historically underrepresented on our nation's college campuses. I should also note that 1 in 3 Oregon degrees, bachelor and higher, earned by students of color, and 1 in 4 STEM and health baccalaureate degrees earned by students of color in Oregon are confirmed by an Alliance member school. In other words, we have 20% to 22% of the students in undergraduate degrees, but among students of color, the percentages are even higher. And we also have the highest graduation rate in Oregon among students of color. 1 in 5 of our students is the first in their family to attend college. And 1 in 3 is eligible for federal Pell Grants. In short, our students are socially, economically, racially, and ethnically diverse. Another private college myth is that it's only available to students of significant financial means. I don't think that can be true if 1 in 3 of our students is Pell eligible. Now, it is true that the advertised price, which represents the actual cost of private college, is very high. But thanks to the generosity of alumni, families, community partners, and friends, 93% of our students are receiving institutional financial aid. In fact, the average institutional grant across all Alliance schools is $20,000 per student. As a result, 28% of our students are graduating with no debt. And the average debt load for students who do have debt is about the same as the students graduating from Oregon's public universities. But finishing college and finishing on time also has important implications for out-of-pocket cost and student debt, as well as the state. Currently, more than 60% of students at private independent colleges in Oregon finish their undergraduate degrees in 4 years. 60%, more than 60%, finish in 4 years. The Higher Education Coordinating Commission currently reports that more than 60% of students at state colleges and universities are taking 6 years to complete their bachelor's degree. Oregon's private colleges and universities offer a 12-to-1 student-to-faculty ratio. Students engage in undergraduate research, internships, and other experiential learning. Small classes, ready access to academic and career advising and other educational services provide critical support and guidance to keep students on track and, as Governor Brown puts it, to graduate on time with a plan for the future. We know that every extra quarter or semester beyond 4 years that it takes a student to finish not only means additional out-of-pocket costs, tuition and fees, room and board, etc., it also means delaying entry or re-entry into the workforce and lost earnings. That's a significant disadvantage for that state, for that student, and I would contend it's not good for the state. It also means lost momentum for students. There's a growing national concern about student debt and how crippling that debt can be, both for those who finish college, but even more for those who don't finish, who never reap the economic benefits of post-secondary degrees. Our students' loan default rates are the lowest in the state of Oregon. And the fact that our default rates are collectively lower tells you something about the affordability of private college. Our graduation rates underscore our commitment to helping students finish and finish on time. And finally, Alliance schools are Oregon's longstanding economic partners. contributing $3.2 billion to the state economy every year. Indeed, some of our colleges are older than the state itself. Collectively, we employ more than 8,800 people who earn more than $400 million a year. Our students also spend money in our local communities, an estimated $750,000 per day on lodging, transportation, and personal expenses. And our alumni, our graduates, love Oregon. We estimate that more than 400,000 alumni graduating from Alliance member schools, that's about half, currently live here. Our graduates embark on a variety of careers or continue their studies at graduate and professional schools or both. Among our graduates are Oregon governors and secretaries of state, chief justices of the Oregon Supreme Court, members of Congress, and the Oregon House and Senate. Our alumni teach our children, provide our health care, and take care of our elders. In short, they make Oregon a better place to live. So here's what I hope you will take away today, from this presentation at least. Oregon's private nonprofit colleges are longstanding partners in achieving the state's attainment and workforce goals. We give high priority to access and affordability, serving a diverse array of students and delivering excellent outcomes. Student success depends on finding the school that's the right fit. Different students learn differently, and student success will ultimately depend on matching students with colleges that best fit their approaches to learning. I grew up on a farm. I was the first person in my family to go to college. There were 36 people in my high school graduating class. It was because I was able to go to a small private liberal arts college that I felt like I fit in and that I was able to succeed. And that story is true for many students even today. Independent colleges must continue to be among the choices available to Oregon students. On behalf of my presidential colleagues, I thank you for this opportunity to speak. I'd like to now introduce Luis Perez Morales, a Linfield student who has a double major in chemistry and math. He's a junior with a 3.9 GPA from McMinnville, Oregon. And I'd like him to tell you briefly about his own private college experience, and we'll then be happy to take your questions. Luis.
Okay. Mr. Chair, representatives, I'd like to start by sharing with you a little bit of what I have been doing for the past 3 years. I have worked on a student-faculty collaborative student research with Dr. Atkinson with the Linfield Chemistry Department. And I had the opportunity to present my findings in the Murdoch Science Conference this past weekend. And I am also going to present them on the American Chemical Society National Meeting on Louisiana in New Orleans next year. I'm also currently the secretary of Pi Mu Epsilon, which is the Honors Mathematics Society in campus. And I'm a TA for the Organic Chemistry Laboratory, a tutor for Probability and Statistics and Organic Chemistry, a first-generation college student. And I'm finishing my degree in 4 years, and I'm graduating debt-free. Before my time is up, I'd like to thank the committee for their support of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And I think that's everything I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Are you speaking as well, or?
No, sir. This is Kristen Granger. I'm president of the Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities. I just defer my time to Luis. He was able to join us at the last minute, so thank you.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Rep. Noble.
Absolutely. I'll make a comment. Full disclosure, I'm an employee at Linfield College and absolutely proud of the work we do. I'm going to comment on President Helley's remarks about cost, because I made a comment to him when we both arrived in McMinnville about 12 years ago in two different positions, in that three of my four children have attended Alliance schools. And costing it out, it was no more expensive than U of O or OSU to attend George Fox and Linfield because of the different endowments, the different packages. So I can attest to that. and working in a small college environment. Luis, my oldest son, is a physician right now. He is a graduate from George Fox. It's not quite Linfield, but it did. Inorganic chemistry, and he also presented at the same conference you will be presenting to next year. That's a very good thing. I'm very proud of that. And then just one remark, even though Representative Clem is not here, there is one NCAA institution right now that we know for sure will be in postseason play in football. I'm not sure there are any others, but there is one.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here and sharing their presentation. I've worked in education in various capacities since my undergrad years, and one of my first jobs was working for a nonprofit in Portland. The nonprofit doesn't exist anymore. But one of the things that was really important in my communication with private nonprofit institutions was trying to increase the diversity among students on campus. And the students I was working with, for many of them, they did have this concept that private institutions were really hard to get into and very costly. And of course, this is 2000, this is a long time ago now. And it sounds like you guys have done a lot of work to really increase the diversity among students. The other point I wanted to make in these conversations, because I ended up joining one of the groups that bring all the nonprofit institutions together to talk about how can we retain students, how can we recruit students, particularly students of color. One of the things that I had mentioned to them and talking to my students at the time was, what do the private institutions do to make sure that the students of color feel connected to the institution, feel like they're supported, particularly with language barriers and parent engagement. Because a lot of the students, it's like yourself, first student to go to college. I was the first student to go to college in my family, and having those support systems is really incredibly important. So it sounds like you guys might be doing something great that is now, where students are really wanting to come to your institutions as opposed to, our state education systems.
Mr. Chair, may I respond to that comment?
Please.
Just a couple of points, but these are examples, and I know Linfield best, so I can talk about these examples at Linfield. Like what I was hearing from the public sector a moment ago, at Linfield we have been reaching out to grade schools as far away as Gresham, but especially in our county. In fact, when I first came to Linfield, I went to our small group of Latino students, and I said, we need to do something to increase enrollment. I'll help you with some money, but I need you to figure out how we can do this. And there were staff involved, too. But we began creating Spanish language programs in the public schools for parents and their children to come and learn about going to college. And then our financial aid staff, who are bilingual, provided help in filling out the FAFSA form, mm-hmm. which people have difficulty with no matter what their first language is. We also have a special Spanish language orientation for parents and their students who are Spanish speaking. We do a number of other things like this. And I think many of our colleges have made this effort because Linfield and many of these schools have always educated first-generation college students. Mm-hmm. And this is just the next wave. Mm-hmm. Did you want to say anything more about your experience as a Latino at Linfield?
Sure. Yeah.
Is it okay?
Absolutely. Okay. Perfect. Thank you. I'd like to say just that there are many clubs on campus where Latino students can join, like LCLA. It's a special group that we have on campus. And it's a really good way to just build a community and just feel part of something. And right now I'm actually a mentor. So I'm mentoring a first-year student, a Latino first-year student that is just coming to Linfield. And yes, I'm just, once again, it's just about building this sense of community between new students.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. And this has been a tremendous presentation. I think the sharing of from all the different types of institutions has been great today and super beneficial. And I feel somewhat challenged. You know, your time to completion is looking pretty impressive. So
We're very proud of it.
We may need to chat some more. So it is approaching 5. I'm getting ready to hit the road, I think. But again, thank you for being here. And I will close this meeting, this informational hearing.
And
I will close the whole hearing. Whole hearing.